saying that her cousin kept quiet in his little compartment. On the street beyond, some revelers had paused to watch the inspection, wide-eyed, curious, and not at all inclined to help the two women inside the carriage. The guard looked them over with a sneer, the expression deepening as his eyes alighted on Lysandra's tattooed wrist.
I owe you nothing, whore.
He spat out another filthy word at both of them, and then shouted,
Search the compartment in the back.
We are on our way to an appointment,
Lysandra hissed, but he slammed the door in her face. The carriage jostled as the men leaped onto the back and opened the rear compartment. After a moment, someone slammed a hand onto the side of the carriage and shouted,
Move on!
They didn't dare stop looking offended, didn't dare stop fanning themselves for the next two blocks, or the two after that, until the driver thumped the top of the carriage twice, all clear. Aelin jumped off the bench and flung open the compartment. Adian had vomited, but he was awake and looking more than a bit put out as she beckoned him to emerge.
One more stop, and then we're there.
Quick, said Lysandra, peering casually out the window. The others are almost here.
The alley was barely wide enough to fit both of the carriages that ambled toward each other. No more than two large vehicles slowing to avoid colliding as they passed. Lysandra flung open the door just as they were aligned with the other carriage, and Kaol's tight face appeared across the way as he did the same.
Go, go, go,
she said to Adian, shoving him over the small gap between the coaches. He stumbled, grunting as he landed against the captain. Lysandra said behind her,
I'll be there soon. Good luck.
Aelin leaped into the other carriage, shutting the door behind her, and they continued on down the street. She was breathing so hard that she thought she'd never get enough air. Adian slumped onto the floor, keeping low. Kaol said,
Everything all right?
She could only manage a nod, grateful he didn't push for any other answers. But it wasn't all right. Not at all. The carriage, driven by one of Kaol's men, took them another few blocks, right to the border of the slums, where they got out on a deserted, decrepit street. She trusted Kaol's men, but only so far. Taking Adian right to her apartment seemed like asking for trouble. With Adian sagging between them, she and Kaol hurried down the next several blocks, taking the long way back to the warehouse to dodge any tail, listening so hard they barely breathed. But then they were at the warehouse, and Adian managed to stand long enough for Kaol to slide the door open before they rushed inside, into the dark and safety at last. Kaol took Aelin's place at Adian's side as she lingered by the door. Grunting at the weight, he managed to get her cousin up the stairs. He's got an injury along his ribs, she said as she forced herself to wait, to monitor the warehouse door for any signs of pursuers. It's bleeding. Kaol gave her a confirming nod over his shoulder. When her cousin and the captain were almost to the top of the stairs, when it became clear no one was about to burst in, she followed them. But pausing had cost her. Pausing had let the razor-sharp focus slip, let every thought she'd kept at bay come sweeping in. Every step she took was heavier than the last. One foot up, then the next, then the next. By the time she made it to the second floor, Kaol had taken Adian into the guest bedroom. The sound of running water gurgled out to greet her. Aelin left the front door unlocked for Lysandra, and for a moment, she just stood in her apartment, bracing a hand on the back of the couch, staring at nothing. When she was certain she could move again, she strode into her bedroom. She was naked before she reached the bathing chamber, and she sat herself right in the cold, dry tub before she turned on the water. Once she emerged, clean and wearing one of Sam's old white shirts and a pair of his undershorts, Kaol was waiting for her on the couch. She didn't dare look at his face. Not yet. Lysandra popped her head in from the guest room.
I'm just finishing cleaning him up. He should be fine if he doesn't burst the stitches again. No infection, thank the gods.
Aelin lifted a limp hand in thanks, also not daring to look into the room behind Lysandra to see the massive figure lying on the bed, a towel around his waist, If Kaol and the courtesan had been introduced, she didn't particularly care. There was no good place to have this talk with Kaol, so she just stood in the center of the room and watched as the captain rose from his seat, his shoulders tight.
"What happened?"
he demanded. She swallowed once. "I killed a lot of people today. I'm not in the mood to analyze it."
"That's never bothered you before."
She couldn't dredge up the energy to even feel the sting of the words.
"The next time you decide you don't trust me, try not to prove it at a time when my life or Adian's is on the line."
A flash of his bronze eyes told her he'd somehow already seen Nezrin. Kaol's voice was hard and cold as ice as he said,
"You tried to kill him. You said you'd try to get him out, to help him. And you tried to kill him."
The bedroom where Lysander was working had gone silent. Aelin let out a low snarl.
"You want to know what I did?
I gave him 1 minute. I gave up 1 minute of my escape to him. Do you understand what can happen in 1 minute? Because I gave one to Dorian when he attacked Adian and me today, to capture us. I gave him 1 minute, in which the fate of my entire kingdom could have changed forever. I chose the son of my enemy."
He gripped the back of the sofa, as though physically restraining himself.
"You're a liar. You've always been a liar. And today was no exception. You had a sword over his head."
"I did," she spat. "And before Felique arrived to wreck everything, I was going to do it. I should have done it, as anyone with common sense would have, because Dorian is gone."
And there was her breaking heart, fracturing at the monster she'd seen living in Dorian's eyes, the demon that would hunt her and Adian down, that would stalk her dreams.
"I do not owe you an apology," she said to Kaol. "Don't talk down to me like you're my queen," he snapped.
"No, I'm not your queen, but you are going to have to decide soon whom you serve, because the Dorian you knew is gone forever. Otterlin's future does not depend on him anymore."
The agony in Kaol's eyes hit her like a physical blow, and she wished she had mastered herself better when explaining it, but she needed him to understand the risk she'd taken, and the danger he'd let Aerobin manipulate him into putting her in. He had to know that there was a hard line that she must draw, and that she would hold, to protect her own people. So she said, "Go to the roof and take the first watch." Kaol blinked.
"I'm not your queen, but I'm going to attend to my cousin right now. And since I hope Nezrin is lying low, someone needs to take the watch. Unless you'd like for us all to be caught unawares by the king's men."
Kaol didn't bother replying as he turned on his heel and strode out. She listened to him storming up the stairs and onto the roof, and it was only then that she loosed a breath and scrubbed at her face. When she lowered her hands, Lysandra was standing in the guest bedroom doorway, her eyes wide.
"What do you mean, queen?"
Aelin winced, swearing under her breath.
"That's exactly the word I'd use,"
Lysandra said, her face pale. Aelin said, "My name..."
"Oh, I know what your real name is, Aelin."
"Shit. You understand why I had to keep it a secret?"
"Of course I do,"
Lysandra said, pursing her lips.
"You don't know me, and more lives than yours are at stake."
"No, I do know you."
Gods, why were the words so damn hard to get out?
The longer the hurt flickered in Lysandra's eyes, the wider the gap across the room felt. Aelin swallowed. "Until I had Adian back, I wasn't going to take any chances. I knew I would have to tell you the moment you saw us in a room together."
"And Aerobin knows."
Those green eyes were hard as chips of ice. "He's always known. This changes nothing between us, you know? Nothing." Lysandra glanced behind her, to the bedroom where Adian now lay unconscious, and loosed a long breath.
"The resemblance is uncanny. Gods, the fact that you went undiscovered for so many years boggles the mind."
She studied Adian again.
"Even though he's a handsome bastard, it'd be like kissing you."
Her eyes were still hard, but a flicker of amusement gleamed there. Aelin grimaced. I could have lived without knowing that. She shook her head. I don't know why I was ever nervous you would start bowing and scraping. Light and understanding danced in Lysandra's eyes.
Where would the fun be in that?
Chapter 20. Several days after running into the wing leader, Aelin Locken's ankle was sore, her lower back a tight knot, and her shoulders aching as she took the last step into the Aerie. At least she'd made it without encountering any horrors in the halls, though the climb had nearly killed her. She hadn't grown accustomed to the steep, endless steps of Morath in the 2 months since she'd been dragged to this horrible place by Vernon. Just completing her daily tasks made her ruined ankle throb with pain she hadn't experienced in years. And today was the worst yet. She would have to scrounge up some herbs from the kitchen tonight to soak her foot. Maybe even some oils, if the ornery cook was feeling generous enough. Compared with some of the other denizens of Morath, he was fairly mild. He tolerated her presence in the kitchen and her requests for herbs, especially when she oh so sweetly offered to clean a few dishes or prepare meals. And he'd never blinked twice when she inquired about when the next shipment of food and supplies would come in, because, oh, she'd loved his whatever fruit pie, and it would be so nice to have it again. Easy to flatter, easy to trick, making people see and hear what they wanted to. One of the many weapons in her arsenal. A gift from Aneth, the Lady of Wise Things, Finula had claimed. The only gift, Aelin often thought, that she'd ever received, beyond her old nursemaid's good heart and wits. She'd never told Finula that she often prayed to the clever goddess to bestow another gift on those who made the years in Perantha living hell. Death. And not the gentle sort. Not like Silba, who offered peaceful ends, or Hellas, who offered violent burning ones. No. Deaths at Aneth's hands, at the hands of Hellas's consort, were brutal, bloody, and slow. The kind of death Aelin expected to receive at any moment these days, from the witches who prowled the halls, or from the dark-eyed duke, his lethal soldiers, or the white-haired wingleader who'd tasted her blood like fine wine. She'd had nightmares about it ever since. That is, when she could sleep at all. Aelin had needed to rest twice on her way to the Aerie, and her limp was deep by the time she reached the top of the tower, bracing herself for the beasts and the monsters who rode them. An urgent message had come for the wingleader while Aelin was cleaning her room, and when Aelin explained that the wingleader was not there, the man heaved a sigh of relief, shoved the letter in Aelin's hand, and said to find her. And then the man had run. She should have suspected it. It had taken 2 heartbeats to note and catalog the man's details, his tells and ticks. Sweaty, his face pale, pupils diluted. He'd sagged at the sight of Aelin when she opened the door. Bastard. Most men, she'd decided, were bastards of varying degrees. Most of them were monsters. None worse than Vernon. Aelin scanned the Aerie. Empty. Not even a handler to be seen. The hay floor was fresh, the feeding troughs full of meat and grain. But the food was untouched by the wyverns whose massive leathery bodies loomed beyond the archways, perched on wooden beams jutting over the plunge, as they surveyed the keep and the army below like 13 mighty lords, limping as close as she dared to one of the massive openings. Aelin peered out at the view. It was exactly as the wingleader's map had depicted it, in the spare moments when she could sneak a look. They were surrounded by ashy mountains, and though she'd been in a prison wagon for the long journey here, she had taken note of the forest she'd spied in the distance, and the rushing of the massive river they had passed days before they ascended the broad, rocky mountain road. In the middle of nowhere, that's where Morath was, and the view before her confirmed it. No cities, no towns, and an entire army surrounding her. She shoved back the despair that crept into her veins. She had never seen an army before coming here. Soldiers, yes. But she'd been 8 when her father passed her up onto Vernon's horse and kissed her goodbye, promising to see her soon. She hadn't been in Orinth to witness the army that seized its riches, its people, and she'd been locked in a tower at Peranth Castle by the time the army reached her family's lands. And her uncle became the king's ever-faithful servant and stole her father's title. Her title, Lady of Peranth. That's what she should have been. Not that it mattered now. There wasn't much of Terrison's court left to belong to. None of them had come for her in those initial months of slaughter. And in the years since, none had remembered that she existed. Perhaps they assumed she was dead. Like Aelin, that wild queen who might have been. Perhaps they were all dead themselves. And maybe, given the dark army now spread before her, that was a mercy. Elide gazed across the flickering lights of the war camp, and a chill went down her spine. An army to crush whatever resistance Finola had once whispered about, during the long nights they were locked in that tower in Peranth. Perhaps the white-haired wingleader herself would lead that army, on the wyvern with shimmering wings. A fierce, cool wind blew into the airy, and Elide leaned into it, gulping it down as if it were fresh water. There had been so many nights in Peranth when only the wailing wind had kept her company. When she could have sworn it sang ancient songs to lull her into sleep. Here the wind was a colder, sleeker thing. Serpentine, almost.
Entertaining such fanciful things will only distract you,
Finola would have chided. She wished her nurse were here. But wishing had done her no good these past 10 years. And Elide, Lady of Peranth, had no one coming for her. Soon, she reassured herself. Soon the next caravan of supplies would crawl up the mountain road. And when it went back down, Elide would be stowed away in one of the wagons, free at long last. And then she would run somewhere far, far away, where they'd never heard of Terrison or Otterlin, and leave these people to their miserable continent. A few weeks. Then she might stand a chance of escaping. If she survived until then. If Vernon didn't decide he truly did have some wicked purpose in dragging her here. If she didn't wind up with those poor people, caged inside the surrounding mountains, screaming for salvation every night. She'd overheard the other servants whisper about the dark, fell things that went on under those mountains. People being splayed open on black stone altars, and then forged into something new. Something other. For what wretched purpose Elide had not yet learned. And mercifully, beyond the screaming, she'd never encountered whatever was being broken and pieced together beneath the earth. The witches were bad enough. Elide shuddered as she took another step into the vast chamber. The crunching of hay under her two small shoes and the clank of her chains were the only sounds.
Wingly,
a roar blasted through the air, the stones, the floor. So loud that her head swam and she cried out. Tumbling back, her chains tangled as she slipped on the hay. Hard, iron-tipped hands dug into her shoulders and kept her upright. If you are not a spy, a wicked voice purred in her ear, then why are you here, Elide Locken? Elide wasn't faking it when her hand shook as she held out the letter, not daring to move. The wingleader stepped around her, circling Elide like prey, her long white braid stark against her leather flying gear. The details hit Elide like stones. Eyes like burnt gold. A face so impossibly beautiful that Elide was struck dumb by it. A lean, honed body. And a steady, fluid grace in every movement, every breath, that suggested the wingleader could easily use the assortment of blades on her. Human only in shape. Immortal and predatory in every other sense. Fortunately, the wingleader was alone. Unfortunately, those gold eyes held nothing but death. Elide said,
This came for you.
The stammer. That was faked. People usually couldn't wait to get away when she stammered and stuttered, though she doubted the people who ran this place would care about the stammer if they decided to have some fun with a daughter of Terrison. If Vernon handed her over. The wingleader held Elide's gaze as she took the letter. I'm surprised the seal isn't broken. Though if you were a good spy, you would know how to do it without breaking the wax.
If I were a good spy, Elide breathed, I could also read.
A bit of truth to temper the witch's distrust. The witch blinked, and then sniffed, as if trying to detect a lie. You speak well for a mortal, and your uncle is a lord. Yet you cannot read? Aleed nodded. More than the leg, more than the drudgery. It was that miserable shortcoming that hounded her. Her nurse, Finula, couldn't read. But Finula had been the one to teach her how to take note of things, to listen, and to think. During the long days when they'd had nothing to do but needlepoint, her nurse had taught her to mark the little details, each stitch, while also never losing sight of the larger image.
There will come a day when I am gone, Aleed, and you will need to have every weapon in your arsenal sharp and ready to strike.
Neither of them had thought that Aleed might be the one who left first. But she would not look back, not even for Finula, once she ran. And when she found that new life, that new place, she would never gaze northward to Terrasen and wonder, either. She kept her eyes on the ground.
I know basic letters, but my lessons stopped when I was 8.
At your uncle's behest, I assume. The witch paused, rotating the envelope and showing the jumble of letters to her, tapping on them with an iron nail. This says Manon Blackbeak. You see anything like this again, bring it to me. Aleed bowed her head, meek, submissive, just the way these witches liked their humans.
Of course.
And why don't you stop pretending to be a stammering, cowering wretch while you're at it? Aleed kept her head bent low enough that her hair hopefully covered any glimmer of surprise.
I've tried to be pleasing.
I smelled your human fingers all over my map. It was careful, cunning work, not to put one thing out of order, not to touch anything but the map. Thinking of escaping after all?
Of course not, mistress.
Oh, gods. She was so, so dead. Look at me. Aleed obeyed. The witch hissed, and Aleed flinched as she shoved Aleed's hair out of her eyes. A few strands fell to the ground, sliced off by the iron nails. I don't know what game you're playing. If you're a spy, if you're a thief, if you're just looking out for yourself. But do not pretend that you are some meek, pathetic little girl when I can see that vicious mind working behind your eyes. Aleed didn't dare drop the mask. Was it your mother or father who was related to Vernon?
Strange question.
But Aleed had known for a while she would do anything, say anything, to stay alive and unharmed.
My father was Vernon's elder brother, she said.
And where did your mother come from? She didn't give that old grief an inch of room in her heart.
She was lowborn, a laundress.
Where did she come from? Why did it matter? The golden eyes were fixed on her, unyielding.
Her family was originally from Rosamel, in the northwest of Terrasen.
I know where it is. Aleed kept her shoulders bowed, waiting. Get out. Hiding her relief, Aleed opened her mouth to make her goodbyes, when another roar set the stones vibrating. She couldn't conceal her flinch. It's just Abraxos, Manon said, a hint of a smile forming on her cruel mouth, a bit of light gleaming in those golden eyes. Her mount must make her happy, then, if witches could be happy. He's hungry. Aleed's mouth went dry. At the sound of his name, a massive triangular head, scarred badly around one eye, poked into the airy. Aleed's knees wobbled, but the witch went right up to the beast and placed her iron-tipped hands on his snout. You swine, the witch said. You need the whole mountain to know you're hungry. The wyvern huffed into her hands, his giant teeth. Oh, gods, some of them were iron, so close to Manon's arms. One bite and the wing leader would be dead. One bite. And yet, the wyvern's eyes lifted and met Aleed's. Not looked at, but met. As if... Aleed kept perfectly still, even though every instinct was roaring at her to run for the stairs. The wyvern nudged past Manon, the floor shuddering beneath him, and sniffed in Aleed's direction. Then those giant, depthless eyes moved down. To her legs. No. To the chain. There were so many scars all over him, so many brutal lines. She did not think Manon had made them, not with the way she spoke to him. Abraxos was smaller than the others, she realized. Far smaller. And yet the wing leader had picked him. Elide tucked that information away, too. If Manon had a soft spot for broken things, perhaps she would spare her as well. Abraxos lowered himself to the ground, stretching out his neck until his head rested on the hay not 10 feet from Elide. Those giant black eyes stared up at her, almost dog-like.
"Enough, Abraxos," Manon hissed, grabbing a saddle from the rack by the wall.
"How do they exist?"
Elide breathed. She'd heard stories of wyverns and dragons, and she remembered glimpses of the little folk and the fae, but... Manon hauled the leather saddle over to her mount.
"The king made them. I don't know how, and it doesn't matter."
The king of Otterlin made them, like whatever was being made inside those mountains. The man who had shattered her life, murdered her parents, doomed her to this.
"Don't be angry,"
Finula had said.
"Be smart."
And soon the king and his miserable empire wouldn't be her concern anyway. Elide said,
"Your mount doesn't seem evil."
Abraxos's tail thumped on the ground, the iron spikes in it glinting. A giant lethal dog with wings. Manon huffed a cold laugh, strapping the saddle into place.
"No. However he was made, something went wrong with that part."
Elide didn't think that constituted going wrong, but kept her mouth shut. Abraxos was still staring up at her, and the wing leader said,
"Let's go hunt, Abraxos."
The beast perked up, and Elide jumped back a step, wincing as she landed hard on her ankle. The wyvern's eyes shot to her, as if aware of the pain. But the wing leader was already finishing with the saddle, and didn't bother to look in her direction as Elide limped out.
"You soft-hearted worm," Manon hissed at Abraxos, once the cunning, many-faced girl was gone.
The girl might be hiding secrets, but her lineage wasn't one of them. She had no idea that witch blood flowed strong in her mortal veins.
"A crippled leg and a few chains, and you're in love."
Abraxos nudged her with his snout, and Manon gave him a firm but gentle slap before leaning against his warm hide and ripping open the letter addressed in her grandmother's handwriting. Just like the High Witch of the Blackbeak clan, it was brutal, to the point, and unforgiving.
"Do not disobey the Duke's orders. Do not question him. If there is another letter from Morath about your disobedience, I will fly down there myself and hang you by your intestines, with your 13 and that runt of a beast beside you. 3 yellow legs and 2 blue blood covens are arriving tomorrow. See to it that there are no fights or trouble. I do not need the other matrons breathing down my neck about their vermin."
Manon turned the paper over, but that was it. Crunching it in a fist, she sighed. Abraxos nudged at her again, and she idly stroked his head.
"Made, made, made."
That was what the Kraken had said before Manon slit her throat.
"You were made into monsters."
She tried to forget it. Tried to tell herself that the Kraken had been a fanatic and a preachy twat. But she ran a finger down the deep red cloth of her cloak. The thoughts opened up like a precipice before her. So many all at once that she stepped back, turned away.
"Made, made, made."
Manon climbed into the saddle and was glad to lose herself in the sky.
"Tell me about the Vog," Manon said, shutting the door to the small chamber behind her.
Ghislaine didn't look up from the book she was poring over. There was a stack of them on the desk before her, and another beside the narrow bed, where the eldest and cleverest of her 13 had gotten them from, who she'd likely gutted to steal them. Manon didn't care.
"Hello, and come right in, why don't you?" was the response.
Manon leaned against the door and crossed her arms. Only with books. Only when reading was Ghislaine so snappish. On the battlefield, in the air, the dark-skinned witch was quiet, easy to command, a solid soldier, made more valuable by her razor-sharp intelligence, which had earned her the spot among the 13. Ghislaine shut the book and twisted in her seat. Her black curly hair was braided back, but even the plate couldn't keep it entirely contained. She narrowed her sea-green eyes, the shame of her mother, as there wasn't a trace of gold in them.
Why would you want to know about the Vogue?
Do you know about them? Ghislaine pivoted on her chair until she was sitting backward in it, her legs straddling the sides. She was in her flying leathers, as if she couldn't be bothered to remove them before falling into one of her books.
Of course I know about the Vogue, she said with a wave of her hand, an impatient mortal gesture.
It had been an exception, an unprecedented exception, when Ghislaine's mother had convinced the High Witch to send her daughter to a mortal school in Terrasen 100 years ago. She had learned magic and book things and whatever else mortals were taught. And when Ghislaine had returned 12 years later, the witch had been different, still a blackbeak, still bloodthirsty, but somehow more human. Even now, a century later, even after walking on and off killing fields, that sense of impatience, of life, clung to her. Manon had never known what to make of it.
Tell me everything.
There's too much to tell you in one sitting, Ghislaine said. But I'll give you the basics, and if you want more, you can come back. An order, but this was Ghislaine's space, and books and knowledge were her domain. Manon motioned with an iron-tipped hand for her sentinel to go on.
Millennia ago, when the Vogue broke into our world, witches did not exist. It was the Vogue and the Fae and humans. But the Vogue were demons, I suppose. They wanted our world for their own, and they thought a good way to get it would be to ensure that their offspring could survive here. The humans weren't compatible, too breakable. But the Fae, the Vogue kidnapped and stole whatever Fae they could. And because your eyes are getting that glazed look, I'm just going to jump to the end and say the offspring became us. Witches. The Iron Teeth took after our Vogue ancestors more, while the Krokens got more of the Fae traits. The people of these lands didn't want us here, not after the war. But the Fae King Brennan didn't think it was right to hunt us all down. So he gave us the Western Wastes, and there we went, until the Witch Wars made us exiles again. Manon picked at her nails. And the Vogue are wicked?
We are wicked, Ghislaine said. The Vogue? Legend has it that they're the origin of evil. They are blackness and despair incarnate.
Sounds like our kind of people. And maybe good ones indeed to ally with. To breed with.
But Ghislaine's smile faded. No, she said softly.
No, I do not think they would be our kind of people at all. They have no laws, no codes. They would see the 13 as weak for our bonds and rules, as something to break for amusement.
Manon stiffened slightly. And if the Vogue were ever to return here?
Brennan and the Fae Queen Maeve found ways to defeat them, to send them back. I would hope that someone would find a way to do so again.
More to think about.
She turned, but Ghislaine said, That's the smell, isn't it? The smell here, around some of the soldiers. Like it's wrong, from another world. The king found some way to bring them here and stuff them into human bodies.
She hadn't thought that far, but
the Duke described them as allies.
That word does not exist for the Vogue. They find the Alliance useful, but will honor it only as long as it remains that way.
Manon debated the merits of ending the conversation there, but said, The Duke asked me to pick a blackbeak coven for him to experiment on, to allow him to insert some sort of stone in their bellies that will create a Vogue Iron Teeth child.
Slowly, Ghislaine straightened, her ink-splattered hands hanging slack on either side of the chair. And do you plan to obey, lady?
Not a question from a scholar to a curious student, but from a sentinel to her heir. The High Witch has given me orders to obey the Duke's every command.
But maybe she would write her grandmother another letter.
Who will you pick?
Manon opened the door. I don't know. My decision is due in 2 days.
Ghislaine, whom Manon had seen glut herself on the blood of men, had paled by the time Manon shut the door. Manon didn't know how. Didn't know if the guards or the Duke or Vernon or some eavesdropping human filth said something. But the next morning, the witches all knew. She knew better than to suspect Ghislaine. None of the 13 talked. Ever. But everyone knew about the Vogue, and about Manon's choice. She strode into the dining hall, its black arches glinting in the rare morning sun. Already, the pounding of the forges was ringing out in the valley below, made louder by the silence that fell as she strode between the tables, headed for her seat at the front of the room. Coven after coven watched, and she met their gazes, teeth out and nails drawn, Sorrel a steady force of nature at her back. It wasn't until Manon slid into her place beside Asterin and realized it was now the wrong place, but didn't move, that chatter resumed in the hall. She pulled a hunk of bread toward her, but didn't touch it. None of them ate the food. Breakfast and dinner were always for show, to have a presence here. The 13 didn't say a word. Manon stared each and every one of them down, until they dropped their eyes. But when her gaze met Asterin's, the witch held it. Do you have something you want to say? Manon said to her. Or do you just want to start swinging? Asterin's eyes flicked over Manon's shoulder. We have guests. Manon found the leader of one of the newly arrived Yellowlegs covens standing at the foot of the table, eyes downcast, posture unthreatening, complete submission.
What?
Manon demanded. The coven leader kept her head low. We would request your consideration for the Duke's task, Wing Leader.
Asterin stiffened, along with many of the 13. The nearby tables had also gone silent. And why, Manon asked, would you want to do that?
You will force us to do your drudgery work, to keep us from glory on the killing fields. That is the way of our clans. But we might win a different sort of glory in this way.
Manon held in her sigh, weighing, contemplating. I will consider it.
The coven leader bowed and backed away. Manon couldn't decide whether she was a fool or cunning or brave. None of the 13 spoke for the rest of breakfast.
And what coven, Wing Leader, have you selected for me?
Manon met the Duke's stare. A coven of yellow legs under a witch named Ninya arrived earlier this week. Use them.
I wanted black beaks.
You're getting yellow legs, Manon snapped.
Down the table, Caltaine did not react.
They volunteered.
Better than black beaks, she told herself. Better that the yellow legs had offered themselves. Even if Manon could have refused them. She doubted Ghislaine was wrong about the nature of the Vogue. But maybe this could work to their advantage, depending on how the yellow legs fared.
The Duke flashed his yellowing teeth.
You toe a dangerous line, Wing Leader.
All witches have to in order to fly wyverns.
Vernon leaned forward.
These wild immortal things are so diverting, Your Grace.
Manon gave him a long, long look that told Vernon that one day, in a shadowy hallway, he would find himself with the claws of this wild, immortal thing in his belly. Manon turned to go. Sorrel, not Asterin, stood stone-faced by the door. Another jarring sight. Then Manon turned back to the Duke, the question forming even as she willed herself not to say it.
To what end? Why do all of this? Why ally with the Vogue? Why raise this army? Why?
She could not understand it. The continent already belonged to them. It made no sense.
Because we can,
the Duke said simply.
And because this world has too long dwelled in ignorance and archaic tradition, it is time to see what might be improved.
Manon made a show of contemplating, and then nodding, as she strode out. But she had not missed the words, this world. Not this land, not this continent. This world.
She wondered whether her grandmother had considered the idea that they might one day have to fight to keep the wastes, fight the very men who had helped them take back their home, and wondered what would become of these Vog Iron Teeth witchlings in that world. Chapter 21. He had tried. When the blood-soaked woman had spoken to him, when those turquoise eyes had seemed so familiar, he had tried to wrest away control of his body, his tongue, but the demon prince in him had held firm, delighting in his struggle. He had sobbed with relief when she trapped it and raised an ancient blade over his head. Then she had hesitated, and then that other woman had fired an arrow, and she had put down the sword and left. Left him still trapped with the demon. He could not remember her name, refused to remember her name, even as the man on the throne questioned him about the incident. Even as he returned to the exact spot in the garden and prodded the discarded shackles lying in the gravel. She had left him, and with good reason. The demon prince had wanted to feed on her, and then hand her over. But he wished she had killed him. He hated her for not killing him. Chapter 22. Kaol left his watch on the roof of Aelin's apartment the moment the hooded head of one of the rebels appeared and signaled that he would take over. Thank the gods. He didn't bother stopping in the apartment to see how Adian was holding up. Each of his pounding steps on the wooden stairs accented the raging, thunderous beat of his heart until it was all he could hear, all he could feel. With the other rebels lying low or monitoring the city, and Nezrin gone to make sure her father wasn't in danger, Kaol found himself alone as he stalked through the city streets. Everyone had their orders. Everyone was where they were supposed to be. Nezrin had already told him Ress and Brollo had given her the signal that all was clear on their end. And now... liar. Aelin was and had always been a goddamned liar. She was as much an oathbreaker as he was. Worse. Dorian wasn't gone. He wasn't. And he didn't give a shit how much Aelin trumpeted about mercy for Dorian, or that she said it was a weakness not to kill him. The weakness lay in his death. That's what he should have said. The weakness lay in giving up. He stormed down an alley. He should have been hiding as well. But the roaring in his blood and bones was unrelenting. A sewer grate rang beneath his feet. He paused and peered into the blackness below. There were still things to do. So many things to do. So many people to keep from harm. And now that Aelin had yet again humiliated the king, he had no doubt that the Vog would round up more people as punishment, as a statement. With the city still in an uproar, perhaps it was the perfect time for him to strike, to even the odds between them. No one saw as he climbed into the sewer, closing the lid overhead. Tunnel after tunnel, his sword gleaming in the afternoon light streaming in through the grates. Kaol hunted those Vog pieces of filth, his steps near silent. They usually kept to their nests of darkness, but every now and then stragglers prowled the tunnels. Some of their nests were small, only three or four of them guarding their prisoners, or meals, he supposed. Easy enough for him to ambush. And wouldn't it be wonderful to see those demon heads roll? Gone. Dorian is gone. Aelin didn't know everything. Fire or beheading couldn't be the only choices. Maybe he would keep one of the Vog commanders alive, see just how far gone the man inside of the demon truly was. Maybe there was another way. There had to be another way. Tunnel after tunnel after tunnel, all the usual haunts, and no sign of them. Not one. Kaol hurried into a near run as he headed for the largest nest he knew of, where they'd always been able to find civilians in need of rescuing. If they were lucky enough to catch the guards unawares. He would save them, because they deserved it, and because he had to keep at it, or else he would crumble and... Kaol stared at the gaping mouth of the main nest. Watery sunlight filtering from above illuminated the gray stones and the little river at the bottom. No sign of the telltale darkness that usually smothered it like a dense fog.
empty. The Vogue soldiers had vanished and taken their prisoners with them. He didn't think they'd gone into hiding from fear. They'd moved on, concealing themselves and their prisoners, as a giant laughing go-to-hell to every rebel who'd actually thought they were winning this secret war. To Kaol. He should have thought of pitfalls like this. Should have considered what might happen when Aelin Galathinius made a fool of the king and his men. He should have considered the cost. Maybe he was the fool. There was a numbness in his blood as he emerged from the sewers onto a quiet street. It was the thought of sitting in his ramshackle apartment, utterly alone with that numbness, that sent him southward, trying to avoid the streets that still teemed with panicked people. Everyone demanded to know what had happened, who had been killed, who had done it. The decorations and baubles and food vendors had been entirely forgotten. The sounds eventually died away, the streets clearing out as he reached a residential district where the homes were of modest size but elegant, well kept. Little streams and fountains of water from the Avery flowed throughout, lending themselves to the surplus of blooming spring flowers at every gate, windowsill, and tiny lawn. He knew the house from the smell alone. Fresh-baked bread, cinnamon, and some other spice he couldn't name. Taking the alley between the two pale-stoned houses, he kept to the shadows as he approached the back door, peering through the pane of glass to the kitchen within. Flour coated a large work table, along with baking sheets, various mixing bowls, and the door swung open, and Nezrin's slim form filled the entryway. "What are you doing here?" She was back in her guard's uniform, a knife tucked behind her thigh. She'd no doubt spotted an intruder approaching her father's house and readied herself. Kaol tried to ignore the weight pushing down on his back, threatening to snap him in two. Adian was free. They'd accomplished that much. But how many other innocents had they doomed today? Nezrin didn't wait for his reply before she said, "Come in." The guards came and went. My father sent them on their way with pastries. Kaol glanced up from his own pear tart and scanned the kitchen. Bright tiles accented the walls behind the counters in pretty shades of blue, orange, and turquoise. He'd never been to Saeed Falik's house before, but he'd known where it was, just in case. He'd never let himself consider what that just in case might entail. Showing up like a stray dog at the back door hadn't been it.
They didn't suspect him?
No. They just wanted to know whether he or his workers saw anyone who looked suspicious before Adian's rescue. Nezrin pushed another pastry, this one almond and sugar, toward him. Is the general all right?
As far as I know.
He told her about the tunnels, the Vogue. Nezrin only said, "So we'll find them again, tomorrow." He waited for her to pace, to shout and swear. But she remained steady, calm, some tight part of him uncoiled. She tapped a finger on the wooden table, lovingly worn, as if the kneading of 1,000 loaves of bread had smoothed it out. Why did you come here?
For distraction.
There was a suspicious gleam in those midnight eyes of hers, enough so that he said,
"Not for that."
She didn't even blush, though his own cheeks burned. If she had offered, he probably would have said yes, and hated himself for it. "You're welcome here," she said. "But surely your friends at the apartment, the general, at least, would provide better company."
"Are they my friends?"
"You and Her Majesty have done a great job trying to be anything but."
"It's hard to be friends without trust."
"You are the one who went to Arabin again, even after she warned you not to."
"And he was right,"
Kaol said.
"He said she would promise not to touch Dorian and then do the opposite."
And he would be forever grateful for the warning shot Nezrin had fired. Nezrin shook her head, her dark hair glimmering. "Let's just imagine that Aelin is right, that Dorian is gone. What then?"
"She's not right."
"Let's just imagine." He slammed his fist on the table hard enough to rattle his glass of water.
"She's not right."
Nezrin pursed her lips, even as her eyes softened. "Why?"
He scrubbed at his face. Because then it's all for nothing. Everything that happened, it's all for nothing. You wouldn't understand.
I wouldn't? A cold question. You think that I don't understand what's at stake? I don't care about your prince, not the way you do. I care about what he represents for the future of this kingdom, and for the future of people like my family. I won't allow another immigrant purge to happen. I don't ever want my sister's children coming home with broken noses again because of their foreign blood. You told me Dorian would fix the world, make it better. But if he's gone, if we made the mistake today in keeping him alive, then I will find another way to attain that future. And another one after that, if I have to. I will keep getting back up, no matter how many times those butchers shove me down. He'd never heard so many words from her at once. Had never even known she had a sister. Or that she was an aunt. Nezrin said, "Stop feeling sorry for yourself. Stay the course, but also plot another one. Adapt." His mouth had gone dry.
"Were you ever hurt? For your heritage?"
Nezrin glanced toward the roaring hearth, her face like ice. "I became a city guard because not a single one of them came to my aid, the day the other schoolchildren surrounded me with stones in their hands. Not one, even though they could hear my screaming." She met his stare again. "Dorian Havilyard offers a better future. But the responsibility also lies with us, with how common people choose to act." "True, so true." But he said,
"I won't abandon him."
She sighed. "You're even more hard-headed than the queen."
"Would you expect me to be anything else?"
A half-smile. "I don't think I would like you if you were anything but a stubborn ass."
"You actually admit to liking me?"
"Did last summer not tell you enough?" Despite himself, Kaol laughed. "Tomorrow," Nezrin said. "Tomorrow we continue on." He swallowed.
"Stay the course, but plot a new path."
He could do that.
He could try it, at least.
"See you in the sewers bright and early."
Chapter 23. Adian rose to consciousness and took in every detail that he could without opening his eyes. A briny breeze from a nearby open window tickled his face. Fishermen were shouting their catches a few blocks away. And someone was breathing evenly, deeply, nearby, sleeping. He opened an eye to find that he was in a small wood-paneled room decorated with care and a penchant for the luxurious. He knew this room, knew this apartment. The door across from his bed was open, revealing the great room beyond, clean and empty and bathed in sunshine. The sheets he slept between were crisp and silken, the pillows plush, the mattress impossibly soft. Exhaustion coated his bones, and pain splintered through his side, but dully. And his head was infinitely clearer as he looked toward the source of that even, deep breathing, and beheld the woman asleep in the cream-colored armchair beside the bed. Her long, bare legs were sprawled over one of the rolled arms, scars of every shape and size adorning them. She rested her head against the wing, her shoulder-length golden hair, the ends stained a reddish-brown, as if a cheap dye had been roughly washed out, strewn across her face. Her mouth was slightly open as she dozed, comfortable in an oversized white shirt, and what looked to be a pair of men's undershorts. Safe. Alive. For a moment, he couldn't breathe. "Aelin." He mouthed her name. As if she heard it, she opened her eyes, coming fully alert as she scanned the doorway, the room beyond, then the bedroom itself for any danger. And then finally, she looked at him and went utterly still, even as her hair shifted in the gentle breeze. The pillow beneath his face had become damp. She just stretched out her legs like a cat and said, "I'm ready to accept your thanks for my spectacular rescue at any time, you know." He couldn't stop the tears leaking down his face, even as he rasped,
"Remind me never to get on your bad side."
A smile tugged at her lips.
and her eyes, their eyes, sparkled. Hello, Adian.
Hearing his name on her tongue snapped something loose, and he had to close his eyes, his body barking in pain as it shook with the force of the tears trying to get out of him. When he'd mastered himself, he said hoarsely,
"Thank you for your spectacular rescue. Let's never do it again."
She snorted, her eyes lined with silver. "You're exactly the way I dreamed you'd be." Something in her smile told him that she already knew, that Ren or Kaol had told her about him, about being Otterland's whore, about the Bane. So all he could say was, "You're a little taller than I'd imagined, but no one's perfect."
"It's a miracle the king managed to resist executing you until yesterday."
"Tell me he's in a rage the likes of which have never been seen before."
"If you listen hard enough, you can actually hear him shrieking from the palace."
Adian laughed, and it made his wound ache. But the laugh died as he looked her over from head to toe.
"I'm going to throttle Ren and the captain for letting you save me alone."
"And here we go."
She looked at the ceiling and sighed loudly. "A minute of pleasant conversation, and then the territorial fey bullshit comes raging out."
"I waited an extra 30 seconds.
Her mouth quirked to the side.
"I honestly thought you'd last 10.
He laughed again, and realized that though he'd loved her before, he'd merely loved the memory, the princess taken away from him. But the woman, the queen, the last shred of family he had.
"It was worth it," he said,
his smile fading.
"You were worth it. All these years, all the waiting, you're worth it."
He'd known the moment she had looked up at him, as she stood before his execution block, defiant and wicked and wild.
"I think that's the healing tonic talking," she said,
but her throat bobbed as she wiped at her eyes. She lowered her feet to the floor. "Kaol said you're even meaner than I am most of the time."
"Kaol is already on his way to being throttled, and you're not helping."
She gave that half-smile again. "Ren's in the north. I didn't get to see him before Kaol convinced him to go there for his own safety."
"Good,"
he managed to say, and patted the bed beside him. Someone had stuffed him into a clean shirt, so he was decent enough. But he managed to haul himself halfway into a sitting position.
"Come here."
She glanced at the bed, at his hand, and wondered whether he'd crossed some line, assumed some bond between them that no longer existed, until her shoulders slumped and she uncoiled from the chair in a smooth feline motion before plopping down on the mattress. Her scent hit him. For a second, he could only breathe it deep into his lungs, his fey instincts roaring that this was his family, this was his queen, this was Aelin. He would have known her even if he were blind. Even if there was another scent entwined with hers, staggeringly powerful and ancient and male. Interesting. She plumped up the pillows, and he wondered if she knew how much it meant to him, as a demi-fey male, to have her lean over to straighten his blankets, too, then run a sharp, critical eye down his face, to fuss over him. He stared right back, scanning for any wounds, any sign that the blood on her the other day hadn't belonged only to those men. But save for a few shallow scabbed cuts on her left forearm, she was unharmed. When she seemed assured that he wasn't about to die, and when he was assured the wounds on her arm weren't infected, she leaned back on the pillows and folded her hands over her abdomen. "Do you want to go first, or should I?" Outside, gulls were crying to each other, and that soft, briny breeze kissed his face.
"You,"
he whispered,
"tell me everything."
So she did. They talked and talked, until Adian's voice became hoarse, and then Aelin bullied him into drinking a glass of water. And then she decided that he was looking peaky, so she padded to the kitchen and dug up some beef broth and bread. Lysandra, Kaol, and Nezrin were nowhere to be seen, so they had the apartment to themselves. Good. Aelin didn't feel like sharing her cousin right now. As Adian devoured his food, he told her the unabridged truth of what had happened to him these past 10 years, just as she'd done for him. And when they were both finished telling their stories, when their souls were drained and grieving,
but gilded with growing joy. She nestled down across from Adian, her cousin, her friend. They'd been forged of the same ore, two sides of the same golden scarred coin. She'd known it when she spied him atop the execution platform. She couldn't explain it. No one could understand that instant bond, that soul-deep assurance and rightness, unless they too had experienced it. But she owed no explanations to anyone, not about Adian. They were still sprawled on the bed, the sun now settling into late afternoon. And Adian was just staring at her, blinking, as if he couldn't quite believe it.
"Are you ashamed of what I've done?"
she dared to ask. His brow creased. "Why would you ever think that?" She couldn't quite look him in the eye as she ran a finger down the blanket.
"Are you?"
Adian was silent long enough that she lifted her head, but found him gazing toward the door, as though he could see through it, across the city, to the captain. When he turned to her, his handsome face was open, soft in a way she doubted many ever saw.
"Never,"
he said.
"I could never be ashamed of you."
She doubted that, and when she twisted away, he gently grabbed her chin, forcing her eyes to him.
"You survived. I survived. We're together again. I once begged the gods to let me see you, if only for a moment. To see you and know you'd made it. Just once. That was all I ever hoped for."
She couldn't stop the tears that began slipping down her face.
"Whatever you had to do to survive, whatever you did from spite or rage or selfishness, I don't give a damn. You're here, and you're perfect. You always were, and you always will be."
She hadn't realized how much she needed to hear that. She flung her arms around him, careful of his injuries, and squeezed him as tightly as she dared. He wrapped an arm around her, the other bracing them, and buried his face in her neck.
"I missed you,"
she whispered onto him, breathing in his scent, that male warrior scent she was just learning. Remembering,
"Every day I missed you."
Her skin grew damp beneath his face.
"Never again,"
he promised. It was honestly no surprise that after Aelin had trashed the vaults, a new warren of sin and debauchery had immediately sprung up in the slums. The owners weren't even trying to pretend it wasn't a complete imitation of the original, not with a name like The Pits. But while its predecessor had at least provided a tavern-like atmosphere, The Pits didn't bother. In an underground chamber hewn from rough stone, you paid for your alcohol with your cover charge. And if you wanted to drink, you had to brave the casks in the back and serve yourself. Aelin found herself somewhat inclined to like the owners. They operated by a different set of rules. But some things remained the same. The floors were slick and reeking of ale and piss and worse. But Aelin had anticipated that. What she hadn't expected exactly was the deafening noise. The rock walls and close quarters magnified the wild cheers from the fighting pits the place had been named after, where onlookers were betting on the brawls within. Brawls like the one she was about to participate in. Beside her, Kaol, cloaked and masked, shifted on his feet.
"This is a terrible idea,"
he murmured.
"You said you couldn't find the Vogue nests anyway,"
she said with equal quiet, tucking a loose strand of her hair, dyed red once more, back under her hood.
"Well, here are some lovely commanders and minions just waiting for you to track them home."
Consider it Arobin's form of an apology. Because he knew that she would bring Kaol with her tonight. She'd guessed as much, debated not bringing the captain. But in the end, she needed him here. Needed to be here herself, more than she needed to upend Arobin's plans. Kaol sliced a glare in her direction, but then shifted his attention to the crowd around them and said again,
"This is a terrible idea."
She followed his stare toward Arobin, who stood across the sandy pit in which two men were fighting, now so bloodied up she couldn't tell who was in worse shape.
"He summons, I answer. Just keep your eyes open."
It was the most they'd said to each other all night, but she had other things to worry about. It had taken just 1 minute in this place to understand why Aerobin had summoned her. The Vol guards flocked to the pits. Not to arrest and torture, but to watch. They were interspersed among the crowd, hooded, smiling, cold. As if the blood and rage fueled them. Beneath her black mask, Aelin focused on her breathing. 3 days after his rescue, Adian was still injured badly enough that he remained bedridden, one of Kaol's most trusted rebels watching over the apartment. But she needed someone at her back tonight, so she'd asked Kaol and Nezrin to come, even if she knew it would play into Aerobin's plans. She'd tracked them down at a covert rebel meeting, to no one's delight. Especially when, apparently, the Volg had vanished with their victims and couldn't be found despite days of tracking them. One look at Kaol's pursed lips had told her exactly whose antics he thought were to blame for it. So she was glad to talk to Nezrin instead, if only to take her mind off the new task pressing on her, its chiming now a mocking invitation from the Glass Castle. But destroying the clock tower, freeing magic, had to wait. At least she'd been right about Aerobin wanting Kaol here. The Volg clearly an offering meant to entice the captain, to continue trusting and confiding in him. Aelin sensed Aerobin's arrival at her side, moments before his red hair slid into her peripheral vision.
Any plans to wreck this establishment, too?
A dark head appeared at his other side, along with the wide-eyed male stares that followed it everywhere. Aelin was grateful for the mask that hid the tightness in her face, as Lysandra inclined her head in greeting. Aelin made a good show of looking Lysandra up and down, and then turned to Aerobin, dismissing the courtesan as if she were no more than a bit of ornamentation. I just cleaned the suit, Aelin drawled to Aerobin. Wrecking this shithole would only mess it up again. Aerobin chuckled.
In case you were wondering, a certain celebrated dancer was on a ship heading south with all her dancers before word of your escapades even reached the docks.
The roar of the crowd nearly drowned out his words. Lysandra frowned at a reveler who nearly spilled his ale on the skirts of her mint and cream gown. Thank you, Aelin said, and meant it. She didn't bring up Aerobin's little game of playing her and Kaol against each other, not when that was precisely what he wanted. Aerobin gave her a smile smug enough to make her ask, Is there a particular reason that my services are necessary here tonight? Or is this another present of yours?
After you so gleefully wrecked the vaults, I'm now in the market for a new investment. The owners of the pits, despite being public about wanting an investor, are hesitant to accept my offer. Participating tonight will go a long way toward convincing them of my considerable assets and what I might bring to the table.
And make a threat to the owners, to show off his deadly arsenal of assassins, and how they might help turn an even higher profit with fixed fights against trained killers. She knew exactly what he would say next.
Alas, my fighter fell through,
Aerobin went on.
I needed a replacement.
And who am I fighting as, exactly?
I told the owners you were trained by the silent assassins of the Red Desert. You remember them, don't you? Give the Pit Lord whatever name you want.
Prick. She'd never forget those months in the Red Desert, or who had sent her there. She jerked her chin at Lysandra. Aren't you a little fussy for this sort of place?
And here I was, thinking you and Lysandra had become friends after your dramatic rescue.
Aerobin, let's go watch somewhere else, Lysandra murmured. The fight's ending. She wondered what it was like to have to endure the man who had slaughtered your lover. But Lysandra's face was a mask of worried, wary mindlessness. Another skin she wore, as she idly cooled herself with a gorgeous fan of lace and ivory. So out of place in this cesspit.
Pretty, isn't it? Aerobin gave it to me, Lysandra said, noticing her attention.
A small trinket for such a tremendously talented lady, Aerobin said,
leaning down to kiss Lysandra's bare neck. Aelin clamped down on her disgust so hard that she choked on it. Aerobin sauntered off into the crowd like a snake through the grass, catching the eye of the willowy pit lord. When he was deep enough into the crowd, Aelin stepped closer to Lysandra. The courtesan glanced away from her, and Aelin knew it wasn't an act. So softly no one could hear, Aelin said, "Thank you for the other day." Lysandra kept her eyes on the crowd and the bloodied fighters around them. They landed on the Volg, and she quickly looked at Aelin again, shifting so that the crowd formed a wall between her and the demons across the pit.
Is he all right?
Yes, just resting and eating as much as he can, Aelin said. And now that Adian was safe, she would soon have to begin fulfilling her little favor to Aerobin. Though she doubted her former master had long to live once Adian recovered and found out what sort of danger Aerobin was putting her in, let alone what he'd done to her throughout the years.
Good,
Lysandra said, the crowd keeping them cocooned. Aerobin clapped the pit lord on the shoulder and stalked back toward them. Aelin tapped her foot until the king of the assassins was between them again. Kaol subtly moved within earshot, a hand on his sword. Aelin just braced her hands on her hips.
Who shall my opponent be?
Aerobin inclined his head toward a pack of the Volg guards.
Whichever one of them you desire. I just hope you choose one in less time than it's taken you to decide which one to hand over to me.
So that was what this was about. Who had the upper hand? And if she refused, with the debt unpaid, he could do worse. So much worse.
You're insane,
Kaol said to Aerobin, following his line of sight.
So he speaks, Aerobin purred.
You're welcome, by the way, for the little tip.
He flicked his gaze toward the gathered Volg. So they were a gift for the captain, then. Kaol glared.
I don't need you to do my work.
Stay out of it, Aelin snapped, hoping Kaol would understand the ire wasn't for him. He turned back toward the blood-splattered sand, shaking his head. Let him be mad. She had plenty to rage at him for anyway. The crowd died down, and the pit lord called for the next fighter.
You're up, Aerobin said, smiling. Let's see what those things are capable of.
Lysandra squeezed his arm, as if pleading for him to let it go. I would keep back, Aelin said to her, cracking her neck.
You wouldn't want to get blood on that pretty dress.
Aerobin chuckled.
Put on a good show, would you? I want the owners impressed, and pissing themselves.
Oh, she would put on a show. After days cooped up in the apartment at Adian's side, she had energy to spare. And she didn't mind spilling some Volg blood. She shoved through the crowd, not daring to draw more attention to Kaol by saying goodbye. People took one look at her and backed away. With the suit, the boots, and the mask, she knew she was death incarnate. Aelin dropped into a swagger, her hips shifting with each step, rolling her shoulders as if loosening them. The crowd grew louder, restless. She sidled up to the willowy pit lord, who looked her over and said,
No weapons.
She merely cocked her head and lifted her arms, turning in a circle, and even allowed the pit lord's little minion to pat her down with his sweaty hands to prove that she was unarmed. As far as they could tell.
Name?
The pit lord demanded. Around her, gold was already flashing.
Ansel of Briarcliff,
she said, the mask distorting her voice to a gravelly rasp.
Opponent?
Aelin looked across the pit, to the crowd gathered, and pointed.
Him.
The Volg commander was already grinning at her. Chapter 24. Kaol didn't know what the hell to think as Aelin leaped into the pit, landing on her haunches. But the crowd had seen whom she'd pointed to and was already in a frenzy, shoving to the front, passing gold as last-minute bets were made. He had to plant his heels to keep from being knocked over the open lip of the pit. No ropes or railings here. If you fell in, you were fair game. A small part of him was glad Nezrin was on watch in the back. And a smaller part of him was glad for a night without more fruitless hunting for the new Volg nests. Even if it meant dealing with Aelin for a few hours. Even if Aerobin Hommel had given him this little gift. A gift that
he hated to admit, he sorely needed and did appreciate. But that was no doubt how Aerobin operated. Kaol wondered what the price would be, or whether his fear of a potential price was payment enough for the King of the Assassins. Dressed head to toe in black, Aelin was a living shadow, pacing like a jungle cat on her side of the pit, as the Vol commander jumped in. He could have sworn the ground shuddered. They were both insane, Aelin and her master. Aerobin had said to choose any one of the Vol. She'd picked their leader. They'd barely spoken since their fight after Adian's rescue. Frankly, she didn't deserve a word out of him. But when she'd hunted him down an hour ago, interrupting a meeting that was so secret that they'd disclosed the location to the rebel leaders only an hour before. Maybe he was a fool, but he couldn't in good conscience say no, if only because Adian would have slaughtered him for it. But since the Vol'g were here, yes, this night had been useful after all. The Pit Lord began shouting the rules. Simply, there were none, save for no blades, just hands and feet and wits. Gods above. Aelin stilled her pacing, and Kaol had to elbow an overeager man in the stomach to keep from being shoved into the pit. The Queen of Terrasen was in a fighting pit in the slums of Rifthold. No one here, he'd wager, would believe it. He was hardly able to believe it himself. The Pit Lord roared for the match to begin, and then they moved. The commander lunged with a punch so swift most men would have had their heads spun around. But Aelin dodged, and caught his arm in one hand, locking it into a hold he knew was bone-snapping. As the commander's face twisted with pain, she drove her knee up into the side of his head. It was so fast, so brutal, even the crowd didn't know what the hell had happened, until the commander was staggering back, and Aelin was dancing on her toes. The commander laughed. Straightening. It was the only break Aelin gave him before she went on the offensive. She moved like a midnight storm. Whatever training she'd had in Wendlin, whatever that prince had taught her, gods help them all. Punch after punch, block, lunge, duck, spin. The crowd was a writhing thing, foaming at the mouth at the swiftness, the skill. Kaol had seen her kill. It had been a while since he'd seen her fight for the enjoyment of it. And she was enjoying the hell out of this. An opponent worthy of her, he supposed, as she locked her legs around the commander's head and rolled, flipping him. Sand sprayed around them. She wound up on top, driving her fist down into the man's cold, handsome face, only to be hurled off with a twist so swift that Kaol could hardly follow the movement. Aelin hit the bloodied sand, and uncoiled to her feet just as the commander attacked once more. Then they were again a blur of limbs and blows and darkness. Across the pit, Aerobin was wide-eyed, grinning, a starving man before a feast. Lysandra clung to his side, her knuckles white as she gripped his arm. Men were whispering in Aerobin's ear, their eyes locked on the pit, as hungry as Aerobin. Either the owners of the pits or prospective clients, bargaining for the use of the woman fighting with such wild wrath and wicked delight. Aelin landed a kick to the commander's stomach that sent him slamming into the rock wall. He slumped, gasping for air. The crowd cheered, and Aelin flung out her arms, turning in a slow circle, death triumphant. The crowd's answering roar made Kaol wonder if the ceiling would come crashing down. The commander hurtled for her, and Aelin whirled, catching him and locking his arms and neck into a hold not easily broken. She looked at Aerobin, as if in question. Her master glanced at the wide-eyed, ravenous men beside him, then nodded to her. Kaol's stomach turned over. Aerobin had seen enough, proved enough. It hadn't even been a fair fight. Aelin had let it go on because Aerobin had wanted it to go on. And once she took out that clock tower and her magic was back, what checks would there be against her? Against Adian, and that Fey Prince of hers, and all the warriors like them? A new world, yes, but a world in which the ordinary human voice would be nothing more than a whisper. Aelin twisted the commander's arms, and the demon shrieked in pain, and then,
Then Aelin was staggering back, clutching at her forearm, at the blood shining bright through the shred in her suit. It was only when the commander whirled, blood slipping down his chin, his eyes pitch black, that Kaol understood. He'd bitten her, Kaol hissed through his teeth. The commander licked his lips, his bloody grin growing. Even with the crowd, Kaol could hear the Volg demon say,
"I know what you are now, you half-breed bitch."
Aelin lowered the hand she'd clapped on her arm, blood shining on her dark glove. "Good thing I know what you are too, prick." End it. She had to end it now. "What's your name?" she said, circling the demon commander. The demon inside the man's body chuckled.
"You cannot pronounce it in your human tongue."
The voice skittered down Kaol's veins, icing them. "So condescending for a mere grunt," she crooned.
"I should bring you down to Morath myself, half-breed, and see how much you talk then. See what you make of all the delicious things we do to your kind."
Morath, Duke Parrington's keep. Kaol's stomach turned leaden. That was where they brought the prisoners who weren't executed, the ones who vanished in the night. To do the gods knew what with them. Aelin didn't give him time to say anything more, and Kaol again wished he could see her face, if only to know what the hell was going on in her head as she tackled the commander. She slammed his considerable weight into the sand and grabbed his head. Crack went the commander's neck. Her hands lingering on either side of the demon's face, Aelin stared at the empty eyes, at the open mouth. The crowd screamed its triumph. Aelin panted, her shoulders hunched, and then she straightened, brushing the sand off the knees of her suit. She gazed up at the pit lord. "Call it." The man blanched.
"Victory is yours."
She didn't bother looking up again as she knocked her boot against the stone wall, freeing a thin, horrible blade. Kaol was grateful for the screams of the crowd as she stomped it down through the neck of the commander. Again. Again. In the dim lighting, no one else could tell the stain in the sand wasn't the right color. No one but the stone-faced demons gathered around them, marking Aelin, watching each movement of her leg as she severed the commander's head from his body and then left it in the sand. Aelin's arms were trembling as she took Aerobin's hand and was hauled out of the pit. Her master crushed her fingers in a lethal grip, pulling her close in what anyone else would have thought was an embrace.
"That's twice now, darling, you haven't delivered."
"I said unconscious." "Bloodlust got the better of me, it seems." She eased back, her left arm aching from the vicious bite the thing had given her. "Bastard." She could almost feel its blood seeping through the thick leather of her boot, feel the weight of the gore clinging onto the toe.
"I expect results, Ansel. And soon."
"Don't worry, master." Kaol was making his way toward a darkened corner, Nezrin a shadow behind him, no doubt readying to track the Volg once they left. "You'll get what's owed to you." Aelin looked toward Lysandra, whose attention wasn't on the corpse being hauled out of the pit by the grunts, but fixed, with predatory focus, on the other Volg guards sneaking out. Aelin cleared her throat, and Lysandra blinked, her expression smoothing into unease and repulsion. Aelin made to slip out, but Aerobin said,
"Aren't you the least bit curious where we buried Sam?"
He'd known his words would register like a blow. He'd had the upper hand, the sure kill shot, the entire time. Even Lysandra recoiled a bit. Aelin slowly turned. "Is there a price for learning that information?" A flick of his attention to the pit.
"You just paid it."
"I wouldn't put it past you to give me a fake location and have me bring stones to the wrong grave." Not flowers. Never flowers in Terrasen. Instead, they carried small stones to graves to mark their visits, to tell the dead that they still remembered. Stones were eternal. Flowers were not.
"You wound me with such accusations."
Aerobin's elegant face told another story.
He closed the distance between them, and said so quietly that Lysandra couldn't hear,
"Do you think you will not have to pay up at some point?"
She bared her teeth.
"Is that a threat?"
"It is a suggestion,"
he said smoothly,
"that you remember what my considerable influences are, and what I might have to offer you and yours during a time when you are desperate for so many things. Money, fighters."
A glance at the vanishing captain and Nezrin.
"Things your friends need, too."
"For a price. Always for a price. Just tell me where you buried Sam and let me leave. I need to clean my shoes." He smiled, satisfied that he'd won, and she'd accepted his little offering. No doubt soon to make another bargain, and then another for whatever she needed from him. He named the location, a small graveyard by the river's edge. Not in the crypts of the Assassin's Keep, where most of them were entombed. Likely meant as an insult to Sam, not realizing Sam wouldn't have wanted to be buried in the keep anyway. "Still," she choked out,
"thank you."
And then she made herself look at Lysandra and drawl, "I hope he's paying you enough." Lysandra's attention, however, was on the long scar marring Aerobin's neck, the scar Wesley had left. But Aerobin was too busy smiling at Aelin to notice.
"We'll be seeing each other again soon," he said. "Another threat. Hopefully when you've upheld your end of the bargain."
The hard-faced men who had been at Aerobin's side during the fight still lingered several feet away. The owners of the pits. They gave her a slight nod that she didn't return. "Tell your new partners I'm officially retired," she said by way of farewell. It was an effort of will to leave Lysandra with him in that hellhole. She could feel the Vogue sentries monitoring her, feel their indecision and malice, and hoped that Kaol and Nezrin didn't run into trouble as she vanished into the open, cool night air. She hadn't asked them to come just to watch her back, but to make them realize precisely how stupid they'd been in trusting a man like Aerobin Hommel. Even if Aerobin's gift was the reason they were now able to track the Vogue back to wherever they were squatting. She just hoped that despite her former master's gift, they at last understood that she should have killed Dorian that day. Chapter 25. Elide was washing dishes, carefully listening to the cook complain about the next scheduled shipment of supplies. A few wagons would arrive in 2 weeks, it seemed, carrying wine and vegetables, and perhaps, if they were lucky, salted meat. Yet it wasn't what was coming that interested her, but how it was carried, what sort of wagons might bear it, and where Elide might best hide in one. That was when one of the witches walked in. Not Manon, but the one named Asterin, golden-haired with eyes like a star-flecked night and a wildness in her very breath. Elide had long ago noted how quick she was to grin, and had marked the moments when Asterin thought no one was looking and gazed across the horizon, her face tight. Secrets. Asterin was a witch with secrets, and secrets made people deadly. Elide kept her head down, shoulders tucked in, as the kitchen quieted in the third's presence. Asterin just swaggered right up to the cook, who had gone pale as death. He was a loud, kind man most days, but a coward at heart.
"Lady Asterin,"
he said, and everyone, Elide included, bowed. The witch smiled, with white normal teeth, thank the gods.
"I was thinking I might help with the dishes."
Elide's blood chilled. She felt the eyes of everyone in the kitchen fix on her.
"As much as we appreciate it, lady."
"Are you rejecting my offer, mortal?"
Elide didn't dare to turn around. Beneath the soapy water, her pruny hands shook. She fisted them. Fear was useless. Fear got you killed.
No, of course, lady. We and Elide will be glad for the help."
And that was that. The clatter and chaos of the kitchen slowly resumed. But conversation remained hushed. They were all watching, waiting, either for Elide's blood to spill on the gray stones, or to overhear anything juicy from the ever-smiling lips of Asterin Blackbeak,
She felt each step the witch took toward her, unhurried, but powerful.
You wash, all dry, the sentinel said at her side.
Aleed peeked out from behind the curtain of hair. Asterin's black and gold eyes glittered.
Thank you, she made herself stammer.
The amusement in those immortal eyes grew. Not a good sign. But Aleed continued her work, passing the witch the pots and plates.
An interesting task for a lord's daughter, Asterin observed, quietly enough that no one else in the bustling kitchen could hear. I'm happy to help.
That chain says otherwise. Aleed didn't falter with the washing, didn't let the pot in her hands slip an inch.
5 minutes, and then she could murmur some explanation and run. No one else in this place is chained up like a slave. What makes you so dangerous, Aleed Locken?
Aleed gave a little shrug. An interrogation, that's what this was. Manon had called her a spy. It seemed her sentinel had decided to assess what level of threat she posed.
You know, men have always hated and feared our kind, Asterin went on. It's rare for them to catch us, to kill us. But when they do, oh, they delight in such horrible things. In the wastes, they've made machines to break us apart. The fools never realized that all they needed to do to torture our kind, to make us beg, she glanced down at Aleed's legs, was to chain us, keep us tied to the earth.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Two of the fowl pluckers had hooked their hair behind their ears in a futile attempt to overhear them, but Asterin knew how to keep her voice low.
You're what? 15? 16?
18?
Small for your age.
Asterin gave her a look that made Aleed wonder if she could see through the homespun dress to the bandage she used to flatten her full breasts into an unnoticeable chest.
You must have been 8 or 9 when magic fell.
Aleed scrubbed at the pot. She'd finish it and go. Talking about magic around these people, so many of them eager to sell any bit of information to the dreadlords who ruled this place. It would earn her a trip to the gallows.
The witchlings who were your age at the time, the sentinel went on, never even had a chance to fly. The power doesn't set in until their first bleeding. At least now they have the wyverns. But it's not the same, is it?
I wouldn't know.
Asterin leaned in close, an iron skillet in her long, deadly hands.
But your uncle does, doesn't he?
Aleed made herself smaller and bought herself a few more seconds of time as she pretended to consider.
I don't understand.
You've never heard the wind calling your name, Aleed Locken. Never felt it tug at you. You've never listened to it and yearned to fly toward the horizon, to foreign lands.
She'd spent most of her life locked in a tower, but there had been nights, wild storms. Aleed managed to get the last bit of burnt food off the pot and rinsed it, handing it to the witch before wiping her hands on her apron.
No, lady, I don't see why I would.
Even if she did want to flee, wanted to run to the other end of the world and wash her hands of these people forever, but it had nothing to do with the whispering wind. Asterin's black eyes seemed to devour her whole.
You would hear that wind, girl,
she said with expert quiet,
because anyone with iron teeth blood does. I'm surprised your mother never told you. It's passed on through the maternal line.
Witch blood, iron teeth blood. In her veins, in her mother's lineage. It wasn't possible. Her blood flowed red. She had no iron teeth or nails. Her mother had been the same. If there was ancestry, it was so old that it had been forgotten, but...
My mother died when I was a child, she said,
turning away and nodding her farewell to the head cook.
She never told me anything.
Pity, Asterin said.
The servants all gawked at Aleed as she limped out, their questioning eyes telling her enough. They hadn't heard.
A small relief, then. Gods. Oh, gods. Witch blood.
Aleed took the stairs up,
each movement sending shooting pains through her leg. Was that why Vernon had kept her chained? To keep her from flying off if she ever showed a lick of power? Was that why the windows in that tower in Paranth had been barred? No. No, she was human. Fully human. But at the very moment these witches had gathered, when she'd heard those rumors about the demons who wanted to breed, Vernon had brought her here, and had become very, very close with Duke Parrington. She prayed to Aneth with every step upward, prayed to the Lady of Wise Things that she was wrong, that the Third was wrong. It wasn't until she reached the foot of the Wingleader's Tower that Elide realized she had no idea where she was going. She had nowhere to go at all. No one to run to. The delivery wagons wouldn't arrive for another few weeks. Vernon could hand her over whenever he wished. Why hadn't he done so immediately? What was he waiting for? To see if the first of the experiments worked before offering her as a bargaining chip for more power? If she was such a valuable commodity, she'd have to go farther than she'd suspected to escape Vernon. Not just to the southern continent, but beyond, to lands she'd never heard of. But with no money, how would she? No money, except for the bags of coins the Wingleader left scattered around her room. She peered up the stairs, stretching into the gloom. Maybe she could use the money to bribe someone. A guard, a lower coven witch, to get her out. Immediately. Her ankle barked in pain as she hurried up the staircase. She wouldn't take an entire bag, but rather a few coins from each, so the Wingleader wouldn't notice. Mercifully, the witch's room was empty, and the various bags of coins had been left out with a carelessness only an immortal witch more interested in bloodshed could achieve. Elide carefully set about stuffing coins in her pocket, the binding around her breasts, and her shoe, so that they wouldn't be discovered all at once, so they wouldn't jingle.
"Are you out of your mind?"
Elide froze. Asterin was leaning against the wall, her arms crossed. The Third was smiling, each of those razor-sharp iron teeth glinting in the afternoon light.
"Bold, mad little thing," the witch said, circling Elide. "Not as docile as you pretend, eh? Oh, gods. To steal from our Wingleader."
"Please," Elide whispered.
Begging, maybe that would work.
"Please, I need to leave this place."
"Why?"
A glance at the pouch of money clenched in Elide's hands.
"I heard what they're doing with the yellow legs. My uncle, if I have your blood, I can't let him use me like that."
"Running away because of Vernon. At least now we know you're not his spy, witchling."
The witch grinned, and it was almost as terrifying as one of Manon's smiles. That was why she'd ambushed her with the knowledge, to see where Elide would run to after.
"Don't call me that,"
Elide breathed.
"Is it so bad to be a witch?"
Asterin spread her fingers, appreciating her iron nails in the dim light.
"I'm not a witch."
"What are you, then?"
"Nothing. I'm nobody. I'm nothing."
The witch clicked her tongue.
"Everybody is something. Even the most common witch has her coven. But who has your back, Elide Locken?"
"No one."
"Only Aneth." And Elide sometimes thought even that could be her imagination.
"There is no such thing as a witch being alone."
"I'm not a witch," she said again.
And once she got away, once she left this festering empire, she'd be no one at all.
"No, she's certainly not a witch," Manon snapped from the doorway, gold eyes cold. "Start talking, now."
Manon had endured a fairly shitty day, which was saying something given her century of existence. The Yellowlegs coven had been implanted in a subterranean chamber of the keep, the room carved into the mountain rock itself. Manon had taken one sniff of that bed-lined room and walked right back out again. The Yellowlegs didn't want her there anyway, while they were cut open by men, while that bit of stone was sewn inside them. No. A blackbeak had no place in a room where yellow legs were vulnerable, and she'd likely make them vicious and lethal as a result.
so she'd gone to training, where Sorrel had kicked her ass in hand-to-hand combat. Then there had been not one, not two, but three different fights to break apart between the various covens, including the Blue Bloods, who were somehow excited about the Volg. They had gotten their noses broken by suggesting to a Blackbeak coven that it was their divine duty not just to go through with the implantation, but also to go so far as to physically mate with the Volg. Manon didn't blame her Blackbeaks for shutting down the talk, but she'd had to dole out equal punishment between the two groups. And then this. Asterin and Alid in her rooms, the girl wide-eyed and reeking of terror, her third seeming to try to convince the girl to join their ranks. Start talking now. Temper. She knew she should rein it in, but the room smelled like human fear, and this was her space. Asterin stepped in front of the girl.
She's not a spy for Vernon, Manon.
Manon did them the honor of listening as Asterin told her what had happened. When she finished, Manon crossed her arms. Alid was cowering by the bathing chamber door, the bag of coins still gripped in her hands.
Where does the line get drawn?
Asterin said quietly. Manon flashed her teeth. Humans are for eating and rutting and bleeding, not helping. If she's got witch blood in her, it's a drop. Not enough to make her our own. Manon stalked toward her third. You are one of the 13. You have duties and obligations. And yet this is how you spend your time? Asterin held her ground.
You said to keep an eye on her, and I did. I got to the bottom of things. She's barely past being a witchling. You want Vernon Locken bringing her down to that chamber? Or over to one of the other mountains?
I don't give a shit what Vernon does with his human pets. But once the words were out, they tasted foul.
I brought her here so you could know.
You brought her here as a prize to win back your position. Alid was still trying her best to vanish through the wall. Manon snapped her fingers in the girl's direction. I'm escorting you back to your room. Keep the money if you want. My third has an airy full of wyvern shit to clean out.
Manon, Asterin began.
Wing leader, Manon growled. When you've stopped acting like a simpering mortal, you may again address me as Manon.
And yet you tolerate a wyvern who sniffs flowers and makes puppy eyes at this girl.
Manon almost struck her, almost went for her throat. But the girl was watching, listening. So Manon grabbed Alid by the arm and yanked her toward the door. Alid kept her mouth shut as Manon led her down the stairs. She didn't ask how the wing leader knew where her room was. She wondered if Manon would kill her once they reached it. Wondered if she'd beg and grovel for mercy when the time came. But after a while, the witch said, if you try to bribe anyone here, they'll just turn you in. Save the money for when you run. Alid hid the shaking in her hands and nodded. The witch gave her a sidelong glance, her golden eyes shimmering in the torchlight. Where the hell would you have run to, anyway? There's nothing within 100 miles. The only way you would stand a chance is if you got on the... Manon snorted. The supply wagons. Alid's heart sank.
Please, please don't tell Vernon.
Don't you think if Vernon wanted to use you like that, he'd have done it already? And why make you play servant?
I don't know. He likes games. He might be waiting for one of you to confirm what I am.
Manon fell silent again, until they rounded a corner. Alid's stomach dropped down to her feet when she beheld who stood in front of her door, as if she'd summoned him by mere thought. Vernon was wearing his usual vibrant tunic, today a terracing green, and his brows rose at the sight of Manon and Alid. What are you doing here? Manon snapped, coming to a stop in front of Alid's little door. Vernon smiled.
Visiting my beloved niece, of course.
Though Vernon was taller, Manon seemed to look down her nose at him, seemed bigger than him as she kept her grip on Alid's arm and said, For what purpose?
I was hoping to see how you two were getting along, her uncle purred. But
he looked at the hand Manon had around Alid's wrist, and the door beyond them,
It seems I needn't have worried.
It took Alid longer to catch it than Manon, who bared her teeth and said, I'm not in the habit of forcing my servants.
Only slaughtering men like pigs, correct?
Their deaths equate to their behavior in life, Manon replied, with a kind of calm that made Alid wonder whether she should start running. Vernon let out a low laugh. He was so unlike her father, who had been warm and handsome and broad-shouldered. A year past 30 when he was executed by the king. Her uncle had watched that execution and smiled, and then come to tell her all about it.
Allying yourself with the witches? Vernon asked Alid. How ruthless of you.
Alid lowered her eyes to the ground. There is nothing to ally against, uncle.
Perhaps I kept you too sheltered for all those years, if you believe that so.
Manon cocked her head. Say your piece and be gone.
Careful, wing leader, Vernon said. You know precisely where your power ends.
Manon shrugged. I also know precisely where to bite. Vernon grinned and bit the air in front of him. His amusement honed itself into something ugly as he turned to Alid.
I wanted to check on you. I know how hard today was.
Her heart stopped. Had someone told him about the conversation in the kitchens? Had there been a spy in the tower just now?
Why would it be hard for her, human?
Manon's stare was as cold as iron.
This date is always difficult for the Locken family, Vernon said. Cal Locken, my brother, was a traitor, you know. A rebel leader for the few months after Terrasen was inherited by the king. But he was caught like the rest of them and put down. Difficult for us to curse his name and still miss him, isn't it, Alid?
It hit her like a blow. How had she forgotten? She hadn't said the prayers, hadn't beseeched the gods to look after him. Her father's death day, and she had forgotten him, as surely as the world had forgotten her. Keeping her head down wasn't an act now, even with the wing leader's eyes on her.
You're a useless worm, Vernon, Manon said. Go spew your nonsense elsewhere.
Whatever would your grandmother say? Vernon mused, stuffing his hands into his pockets.
About such behavior.
Manon's growl chased after him as he sauntered down the hall. Manon flung open Alid's door, revealing a room barely big enough for a cot and a pile of clothes. She hadn't been permitted to bring any belongings, none of the keepsakes that Finula had hidden all these years. The small doll her mother had brought back from a trip to the southern continent, her father's seal ring, her mother's ivory comb, the first gift Cal Locken had given Marion the laundress while courting her. Apparently Marion the Iron Teeth Witch would have been a better name. Manon shut the door with a backward kick. Too small. The room was too small for two people, especially when one of them was ancient and dominated the space just by breathing. Alid slumped onto the cot, if only to put more air between her and Manon. The wing leader stared at her for a long moment, and then said, You can choose, witchling. Blue or red.
What?
Does your blood run blue or red? You decide. If it runs blue, it turns out I have jurisdiction over you. Little shits like Vernon can't do as they will to my kind, not without my permission. If your blood runs red, well, I don't particularly care about humans, and seeing what Vernon does with you might be entertaining.
Why would you offer this?
Manon gave her a half smile, all iron teeth and no remorse. Because I can.
If my blood runs blue, won't it confirm what Vernon suspects? Won't he act?
A risk you'll have to take. He can try to act on it and learn where it gets him.
A trap, and Alid was the bait. Claim her heritage as a witch, and if Vernon took her to be implanted, Manon could have the grounds to kill him. She had a feeling Manon might hope for that. It was not just a risk. It was a suicidal, stupid risk, but better than nothing. The witches, who lowered their eyes for no man. Until she could get away, perhaps she might learn a thing or two about what it was like to have fangs and claws.
and how to use them.
Blue, she whispered. My blood runs blue.
Good choice, witchling, Manon said, and the word was a challenge and an order. She turned away, but glanced over her shoulder. Welcome to the Blackbeaks.
Witchling.
Alid stared after her. She had likely just made the biggest mistake of her life, but it was strange. Strange, that feeling of belonging.
Chapter 26.
I'm not about to keel over dead, Adian said to his cousin, his queen, as she helped him walk around the roof. This was their third rotation, the moon shimmering on the tiles beneath them. It was an effort to keep upright. Not from the steady throb in his side, but from the fact that Aelin was beside him, an arm around his waist. A cool night breeze laced with the plume of smoke on the horizon wrapped around him, chilling the sweat on his neck. But he angled his face away from the smoke, breathing in another, better smell, and found the source of it frowning up at him. Aelin's exquisite scent soothed him, awakened him. He'd never get sick of that scent. It was a miracle. But her frown, that was not a miracle. What? He demanded. It had been a day since she'd fought in the pits, a day of more sleeping. Tonight, under the cover of darkness, was the first he'd been able to get out of bed. If he were cooped up here for another moment, he'd start tearing down the walls. He'd had enough of cages and prisons.
I'm making my professional assessment, she said, keeping pace beside him.
As an assassin, queen, or pit brawler? Aelin gave him a grin, the sort that told him she was debating kicking his ass.
Don't be jealous that you didn't get a shot at those Volg bastards.
It wasn't that. She'd been fighting Volg last night, while he'd lain in bed, unaware she was in any sort of danger at all. He tried to convince himself that despite the peril, despite how she'd returned reeking of blood and injured from where one of them had bitten her, she'd at least learned that Morath was where the people with magic were being turned into Volg vessels. Tried to convince himself, and failed, but he had to give her space. He wouldn't be an overbearing territorial fey bastard, as she liked to call them. And if I pass your assessment, Adian said at last, will we go directly to Terrasen? Or are we waiting here for Prince Rowan? Prince Rowan, she said, rolling her eyes.
You keep needling me for details about Prince Rowan.
You befriended one of the greatest warriors in history, perhaps the greatest warrior alive. Your father and his men all told me stories about Prince Rowan.
What?
Oh, he'd been waiting to drop this particular gem of information. Warriors in the North still talk about him.
Rowan's never been to this continent.
She said it with such casualness. Rowan. She really had no clue who she now considered a member of her court, who she'd freed from his oath to Maeve, who she frequently referred to as a pain in her ass. Rowan was the most powerful, full-blooded fey male alive, and his scent was all over her. Yet she had no god's damned idea. Rowan Whitethorn is a legend, and so is his, what do you call them?
Cadre, she said glumly.
The six of them, Adian loosed a breath. We used to tell stories about them around fires, their battles and exploits and adventures. She sighed through her nose.
Please, please don't ever tell him that. I'll never hear the end of it, and he'll use it in every argument we have.
Honestly, Adian didn't know what he would say to the male, because there were many, many things to say. Expressing his admiration would be the easy part. But when it came to thanking him for what he'd done for Aelin this spring, or what exactly Rowan expected as a member of their court, if the Fey Prince expected to be offered the Blood Oath, then it was an effort to keep from tightening his grip on Aelin.
Ren already knew that the Blood Oath was Adian's by right, and any other child of Terrasen would know too.
So first thing Adian would do when the prince arrived would be to make sure he understood that little fact. It wasn't like in Wendlin, where warriors were offered the oath whenever their ruler pleased. No. Since Brannan had founded Terrasen,
its kings and queens had picked only one of their court to swear the blood oath, usually at their coronation or soon after. Just one, for their entire lives. Adian had no interest in yielding the honor, even to the legendary warrior prince. Anyway, Aelin said sharply, as they rounded the corner of the roof again, we're not going to Terrasen. Not yet. Not until you're well enough to travel hard and fast. Right now, we need to get the Amulet of Orinth from Aerobin. Adian was half tempted to hunt down her former master and rip him to shreds as he interrogated him about where the amulet was kept, but he could play along with her plan. He was still weak enough that until now, he'd barely been able to stand long enough to piss. Having Aelin help him the first time had been awkward enough that he couldn't even go until she started singing a bawdy tune at the top of her lungs and turned on the sink faucet, all the while helping him stand over the toilet. Give me another day or two, and I'll help you hunt down one of those demon pricks for him. Rage slammed into him, as hard as any physical blow. The King of the Assassins had demanded she put herself in such danger, as if her life, as if the fate of their kingdom were a god's damned game to him. But Aelin had struck that bargain. For him. Again, breathing became hard. How many scars would she add to that lithe, powerful body because of him? Then Aelin said, you're not going to hunt the Vog with me. Adian stumbled a step.
Oh, yes, I am.
No, you're not, she said. One, you're too recognizable.
Don't even start.
She observed him for a long moment, as if assessing his every weakness and strength. At last she said, very well. He almost sagged in relief.
But after all that? The Vog? The amulet?
Adian pushed.
Will we free magic?
A nod.
I assume you have a plan.
Another nod. He gritted his teeth.
Do you care to share it?
Soon, she said sweetly.
Gods help him.
And after completing your mysterious, wonderful plan, we'll go to Terrasen. He didn't want to ask about Dorian. He'd seen the anguish on her face that day in the garden. But if she couldn't put the princeling down, he'd do it. He wouldn't enjoy it, and the captain might very well kill him in return. But to keep Terrasen safe, he'd cut off Dorian's head. Aelin nodded. Yes, we'll go. But you only have one legion.
There are men who would fight, and other territories that might come if you call.
We can discuss this later. He leashed his temper.
We need to be in Terrasen before the summer is out, before the snow starts falling in autumn, or else we wait until spring.
She nodded distantly. Yesterday afternoon, she dispatched the letters Adian had asked her to write, to Ren, the Bane, and the remaining loyal lords of Terrasen, letting them know they'd been reunited, and that anyone with magic in their veins was to lie low. He knew the remaining lords, the old cunning bastards, wouldn't appreciate orders like that, even from their queen. But he had to try.
And, he added, because she really was going to shut him down about this, we'll need money for that army.
She said quietly, I know. Not an answer. Adian tried again.
Even if men agree to fight on their honor alone, we stand a better chance of having greater numbers if we can pay them, not to mention feeding our forces and arming and supplying them.
For years now, he and the Bane had traversed from tavern to tavern, quietly raising funds for their own efforts. It still killed him to see the poorest of his people plunk hard-earned coins into the pans they'd passed around, to see the hope in their gaunt, scarred faces.
The King of Otterlin emptied our royal coffers. It was one of the first things he did. The only money we have comes from whatever our people can donate, which isn't much, or whatever is granted by Otterlin.
Another way of keeping control all these years, she murmured.
Our people are beggared. They don't have two coppers to rub together these days, let alone to pay taxes.
I wouldn't raise taxes to pay for a war, she said sharply, and I'd rather not whore ourselves to foreign nations for loans either. Not yet, anyway.
Adian's throat tightened at the bitterness coating her tone, as they both considered the other way money and men could be obtained.
but he couldn't bring himself to mention selling her hand in marriage to a wealthy foreign kingdom. Not yet. So he just said,
"It's something to start contemplating. If magic is indeed freed, we could recruit the wielders to our side. Offer them training, money, shelter. Imagine a soldier who can kill with blade and magic. It could turn the tide of a battle."
Shadows flickered in her eyes. "Indeed." He weighed her posture, the clarity of her gaze, her tired face. Too much. She'd already faced and survived too much. He'd seen the scars, the tattoos that covered them, peeking over the collar of her shirt every now and then. He hadn't yet dared to ask to see them. The bandaged bite on her arm was nothing compared to that pain, and the many others she hadn't mentioned. The scars all over her. The scars all over both of them.
"And then," he said, clearing his throat, "there's the blood oath."
He'd had endless hours in bed to compile this list. She stiffened enough that Adian quickly added,
"You don't have to, not yet. But when you're ready, I'm ready."
"You still want to swear it to me?"
Her voice was flat.
"Of course I do."
He damned caution to hell and said,
"It was my right then and now. It can wait until we get to Terrison. But it's going to be me who takes it. No one else."
Her throat bobbed.
"Right."
A breathless answer that he couldn't read. She let go of him and stalked toward one of the little training areas to test out her injured arm. Or maybe she wanted to get away from him. Maybe he'd broached the topic the wrong way. He might have hobbled off the roof had the door not opened and the captain appeared. Aelin was already striding toward Kaol with predatory focus. He'd hate to be on the receiving end of that gate.
"What is it?" she said.
He'd hate to be on the receiving end of that greeting, too. Adian limped for them as Kaol kicked the door shut behind him.
"The shadow market is gone."
Aelin drew up short. "What do you mean?" The captain's face was tight and pale.
"The Vogue soldiers. They went to the market tonight and sealed the exits with everyone inside. Then they burnt it. The people who tried to escape through the sewers found garrisons of soldiers waiting there, swords ready."
That explained the smoke in the air, the plume on the horizon. Holy gods.
The king had to have lost his mind entirely, had to have stopped caring what the general public thought. Aelin's arms slackened at her sides.
"Why?"
The slight tremor in her voice had Adian's hackles rising. Those fey instincts roaring to shut the captain up, to rip out his throat, to end the cause of her pain and fear.
"Because it got out that the rebels who freed him,"
Kaol sent a cutting glance in Adian's direction,
"were meeting in the shadow market to buy supplies."
Adian reached her side, close enough now to see the tightness of the captain's face, the gauntness that hadn't been there weeks ago. The last time they'd spoken.
"And I suppose you blame me?"
Aelin said with midnight softness. A muscle flickered on the captain's jaw. He didn't even nod a greeting to Adian, or acknowledge the months they'd spent working together. What had happened in that tower room?
"The king could have ordered their slaughter by any means,"
Kaol said, the slender scar on his face stark in the moonlight.
"But he chose fire."
Aelin went impossibly still.
Adian snarled, "You're a prick for suggesting the attack was a message for her."
Kaol at last turned his attention toward him.
"You think it's not true?"
Aelin cocked her head.
"You came all this way to fling accusations in my face?"
"You told me to stop by tonight,"
Kaol retorted, and Adian was half tempted to punch his teeth down his throat for the tone he used.
"But I came to ask why you haven't moved on the clock tower. How many more innocent people are going to be caught in the crossfire of this?"
It was an effort to keep his mouth shut. He didn't need to speak for Aelin, who said with flawless venom,
"Are you suggesting that I don't care?"
"You risked everything, multiple lives, to get out one man. I think you find this city and its citizens to be expendable."
Aelin hissed.
"Need I remind you, Captain, that you went to Endovir and did not blink at the slaves, at the mass graves?
Need I remind you that I was starved and chained, and you let Duke Parrington force me to the ground at Dorian's feet while you did nothing?
And now you have the nerve to accuse me of not caring.
When many of the people in this city have profited off the blood and misery of the very people you ignored.
Adian stifled the snarl working its way up his throat. The captain had never said that about the initial meeting with his queen. Never said he hadn't stepped in while she was manhandled, humiliated. Had the captain even flinched at the scars on her back? Or merely examined them as though she were some prize animal?
You don't get to blame me,
Aelin breathed.
You don't get to blame me for the Shadow Market.
This city still needs protecting, Kaol snapped.
Aelin shrugged, heading for the roof door.
Or maybe this city should burn,
she murmured. A chill went down Adian's spine, even though he knew she'd said it to piss off the captain.
Maybe the world should burn,
she added, and stalked off the roof. Adian turned to the captain.
You want to pick a fight? You come to me, not her.
The captain just shook his head and stared across the slums. Adian followed his gaze, taking in the capital twinkling around them. He'd hated this city from the very first time he'd spotted the white walls, the glass castle. He'd been 19, and had bedded and reveled his way from one end of Rifthold to the other, trying to find something, anything to explain why Otterlin thought it was so god's damned superior, why Terrasen had fallen to its knees before these people. And when Adian had finished with the women and the parties, after Rifthold had dumped its riches at his feet and begged him for more, 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 he'd still hated it, even more than before. And all that time, and every time after, he'd had no idea that what he truly sought, what his shredded heart still dreamed of, was dwelling in a house of killers mere blocks away. At last, the captain said,
You look more or less in one piece.
Adian gave him a wolf's grin. And you won't be if you speak to her that way again. Kaol shook his head.
Did you learn anything about Dorian while you were in the castle?
You insult my queen, and yet have the nerve to ask me for that information?
Kaol rubbed his brows with his thumb and forefinger.
Please, just tell me. Today has been bad enough.
Why?
I've been hunting the Vald commanders in the sewers since the fight in the pits. We tracked them to their new nests, thank the gods, but found no sign of humans being held prisoner. Yet more people have vanished than ever, right under our noses. Some of the other rebels want to abandon Rifthold, establish ourselves in other cities in anticipation of the Vog spreading.
And you?
I don't leave without Dorian.
Adian didn't have the heart to ask if that meant alive or dead. He sighed. He came to me in the dungeons, taunted me.
There was no sign of the man inside him. He didn't even know who Sorsha was.
And then, maybe because he was feeling particularly kind, thanks to the golden-haired blessing in the apartment beneath, Adian said,
I'm sorry about Dorian.
Kaol's shoulders sagged, as if an invisible weight pushed against them.
Otterlin needs to have a future.
So make yourself king.
I'm not fit to be king.
The self-loathing in those words made Adian pity the captain, despite himself. Plans. Aelin had plans for everything, it seemed. She had invited the captain over tonight, he realized, not to discuss anything with her, but for this very conversation. He wondered when she would start confiding in him. These things took time, he reminded himself. She was used to a lifetime of secrecy. Learning to depend on him would take a bit of adjustment.
I can think of worse alternatives, Adian said. Like Holland. And what will you and Aelin do about Holland?
Kaol asked, gazing toward the smoke.
Where do you draw the line?
We don't kill children.
Even ones who already show signs of corruption?
You don't get the right to fling that sort of horseshit in our faces. Not when your king murdered our family. Our people.
Kaol's eyes flickered.
I'm sorry.
Adian shook his head.
We're not enemies. You can trust us. Trust Aelin. No, I can't. Not anymore.
Then it's your loss,
Adian said. Good luck. It was all he really had to offer the captain.
Kaol stormed out of the warehouse apartment and across the street to where Nezrin was leaning against a building, arms crossed. Beneath the shadows of her hood, her mouth quirked to the side.
What happened?
He continued down the street, his blood roaring in his veins.
Nothing.
What did they say?
Nezrin kept up with him, meeting him step for step.
None of your business, so drop it. Just because we work together doesn't mean you're entitled to know everything that goes on in my life.
Nezrin stiffened almost imperceptibly, and part of Kaol flinched, already yearning to take the words back.
But it was true.
He'd destroyed everything the day he fled the castle. And maybe he'd taken to hanging around with Nezrin because there was no one else who didn't look at him with pity in their eyes. Maybe it had been selfish of him to do it. Nezrin didn't bother with a goodbye before vanishing down an alley. At least he couldn't hate himself any more than he already did. Lying to Adian about the blood oath was awful. She would tell him. She would find a way to tell him. When things were less new, when he stopped looking at her as though she were a god's damned miracle and not a lying, cowardly piece of shit. Maybe the shadow market had been her fault. Crouched on a rooftop, Aelin shook off the cloak of guilt and temper that had been smothering her for hours, and turned her attention to the alley below. Perfect. She'd tracked several different patrols tonight, noting which of the commanders wore black rings, which seemed more brutal than the rest, which didn't even try to move like humans. The man, or was he a demon now, hauling open a sewer grate in the street below, was one of the milder ones. She'd wanted to shadow this commander to wherever he made his nest, so she could at least give Kaol that information, prove to him how invested she was in the welfare of this piss-poor city. This commander's men had headed for the glowing glass palace, the thick river fog casting the entire hillside in greenish light. But he had veered away, going deeper into the slums and to the sewers beneath them. She watched him disappear through the sewer grate, then nimbly climbed off the roof, hurrying for the closest entrance that would connect to his. Swallowing that old fear, she quietly entered the sewers a block or two down from where he'd climbed in, and listened carefully. Dripping water, the reek of refuse, the scurrying of rats, and splashing steps ahead, around the next big intersection of tunnels. Perfect. Aelin kept her blades concealed in her suit, not wanting them to rust in the sewer dampness. She clung to the shadows, her steps soundless as she neared the crossroads and peered around the corner. Sure enough, the Volg commander was striding down the tunnel, his back to her, headed deeper into the system. When he was far enough ahead, she slipped around the corner, keeping to the darkness, avoiding the patches of light that shone through the overhead grates. Tunnel after tunnel, she trailed him, until he reached a massive pool. It was surrounded by crumbling walls covered in grime and moss, so ancient that she wondered if they'd been among the first built in Rifthold. But it wasn't the man kneeling before the pool, its waters fed by rivers snaking in from either direction, that made her breath catch and panic flood her veins. It was the creature that emerged from the water.
Chapter 27.
The creature rose, its black stone body cutting through the water with hardly a ripple. The Volg commander knelt before it, head down, not moving a muscle as the horror uncoiled to its full height. Her heart leaped into a wild beat, and she willed it to calm as she took in the details of the creature that now stood waist deep in the pool, water dripping off its massive arms and elongated serpentine snout. She'd seen it before. One of eight creatures carved into the clock tower itself. Eight gargoyles that she'd once sworn had watched her, smiled at her. Was there currently one missing from the clock tower? Or had the statues been molded after this monstrosity? She willed strength to her knees. A faint blue light began pulsing from beneath her suit. Shit. The eye. Never a good sign when it flared. Never, never, never.
She put a hand over it, smothering the barely perceptible glow.
Report.
The thing hissed through a mouth of dark stone teeth. Wordhound. That's what she would call it. Even if it didn't look remotely like a dog, she had the feeling that the gargoyle thing could track and hunt as well as any canine, and obeyed its master well. The commander kept his head lowered.
No sign of the general, or those who helped him get away. We received word that he'd been spotted heading down the southern road, riding with 5 others for Fenharrow. I sent 2 patrols after them.
She could thank Arabin for that.
Keep looking,
the wordhound said, the dim light glinting on the iridescent veins running through its obsidian skin.
The general was injured. He can't have gotten far.
The creature's voice stopped her cold. Not the voice of a demon, or a man, but the king. She didn't want to know what sort of things he'd done in order to see through this thing's eyes, speak through its mouth. A shudder crawled down her spine as she backed down the tunnel. The water running beside the raised walkway was shallow enough that the creature couldn't possibly swim there. But she didn't dare breathe too loudly. Oh, she'd give Arabin his Volg commander, all right. Then she'd let Kaol and Nezrin hunt them all into extinction. But not until she had the chance to speak to one on her own. It took Aelin 10 blocks to stop the shaking in her bones. 10 blocks to debate whether she would even tell them what she'd seen and what she had planned. But walking in the door and seeing Adian pacing by the window was enough to set her on edge again. Would you look at that, she drawled, throwing back her hood. I'm alive and unharmed.
You said 2 hours. You were gone 4.
I had things to do, things that only I can do, so to accomplish those things, I needed to get out. You're in no shape to be in the streets, especially if there's danger.
You swore there wasn't any danger.
Do I look like an oracle? There is always danger. Always. That wasn't even the half of it.
You reek of the god's damned sewers, Adian snapped. Wanna tell me what you were doing there?
No, not really.
Adian rubbed at his face. Do you understand what it was like to sit on my ass while you were gone? You said 2 hours. What was I supposed to think?
Adian, she said as calmly as she could, and pulled off her filthy gloves before taking his broad, calloused hand. I get it. I do.
What were you doing that was so important it couldn't wait a day or two?
His eyes were wide, pleading. Scouting.
You're good at this, aren't you? Half-truths.
One, just because you're you, it doesn't entitle you to information about everything I do. 2,
there you go with the lists again.
She squeezed his hand hard enough to shatter a lesser man's bones. If you don't like my lists, then don't pick fights with me. He stared at her. She stared right back. Unyielding, unbreakable. They'd been cut from the same cloth. Adian loosed a breath and looked at their joined hands, then opened his to examine her scarred palm, crisscrossed with the marks of her vow to Nehemia and the cut she'd made the moment she and Rowan became Karanam, their magic joining them in an eternal bond.
It's hard not to think all of your scars are my fault.
Oh. Oh. It took her a breath or two, but she managed to cock her chin at a devious angle and say, Please, half of these scars I rightly deserved. She showed him a small scar down the inside of her forearm. See that one? A man in a tavern sliced me open with a bottle after I cheated him in a round of cards and tried to steal his money. A choked sound came from him. You don't believe me?
Oh, I believe you. I didn't know you were so bad at cards that you had to resort to cheating.
Adian chuckled quietly, but the fear lingered. So she peeled back the collar of her tunic to reveal a thin necklace of scars. Baba Yellowlegs, matron of the Yellowlegs Witch Clan, gave me these when she tried to kill me. I cut off her head, then cut her corpse into little bits, then shoved it all into the oven of her wagon.
I wondered who killed Yellowlegs.
She could have embraced him for that sentence alone, for the lack of fear or disgust in those eyes.
She walked to the buffet table and pulled out a bottle of wine from inside the cabinet. I'm surprised you beasts didn't drink all my good alcohol these past months. She frowned at the cabinet. Looks like one of you got into the brandy.
Ren's grandfather,
Adian said, tracking her movements from his spot by the window. She opened the bottle of wine and didn't bother with a glass as she slumped onto the couch and swigged. This one, she said, pointing to a jagged scar by her elbow. Adian came around the couch to sit beside her. He took up nearly half of the damn thing. The pirate lord of Skull's Bay gave that to me after I trashed his entire city, freed his slaves, and looked damn good while doing it. Adian took the bottle of wine and drank from it.
Has anyone ever taught you humility?
You didn't learn it, so why should I? Adian laughed, and then showed her his left hand. Several of the fingers were crooked.
In the training camps, one of those Otterlanian bastards broke every finger when I mouthed off. Then he broke them in a second place because I wouldn't stop swearing at him after.
She whistled through her teeth, even as she marveled at the bravery, the defiance, even as pride for her cousin mingled with the slightest tinge of shame for herself. Adian yanked up his shirt to reveal a muscled abdomen, where a thick, jagged slash plunged from his ribs to his belly button.
Battle near Rosamel. 6-inch serrated hunting knife curved on the tip. Rutting prick got me here.
He pointed to the top, then dragged his finger down,
and sliced south.
Shit, she said. How the hell are you still breathing?
Luck. And I was able to move as he dragged it down, keeping him from gutting me. At least I learned the value of shielding after that.
So they went on through the evening and the night, passing the wine between them. One by one, they told the stories of the wounds accumulated in the years spent apart. And after a while, she peeled off her suit and turned to show him her back, to show him the scars and the tattoos she'd had etched over them. When she again reclined on the couch, Adian showed her the scar across his left pectoral from the first battle he'd fought, when he'd finally been able to win back the sword of Orinth, her father's sword. He padded to what she now considered his room, and when he returned, he held the sword in his hands as he knelt.
This belongs to you,
he said hoarsely. Her swallow was loud in her ears. She folded Adian's hands around the scabbard, even as her heart fractured at the sight of her father's blade, at what he had done to attain it, to save it.
It belongs to you, Adian.
He didn't lower the blade.
It was just for safekeeping.
It belongs to you, she said again. There is no one else who deserves it.
Not even her, she realized. Adian took a shuddering breath and bowed his head. You're a sad drunk, she told him, and he laughed. Adian set the sword on the table behind him and slumped back onto the couch. He was large enough that she was nearly popped off her own cushion, and she glared at him as she straightened. Don't break my couch, you hulking brute. Adian ruffled her hair and stretched his long legs out before him.
10 years, and that's the treatment I get from my beloved cousin.
She elbowed him in the ribs. 2 more days passed, and Adian was going out of his mind, especially as Aelin kept sneaking out only to return covered in filth and reeking to Hellas's fiery realm. Going to the rooftop for fresh air wasn't the same as going out, and the apartment was small enough that he was starting to contemplate sleeping in the warehouse downstairs to have some sense of space. He always felt that way, though, whether in Rifthold or Orinth or at the finest of palaces. If he went too long without walking through forests or fields, without the kiss of the wind on his face, gods above, he'd even take the Bane's war camp over this. It had been too long since he'd seen his men, laughed with them, listened to and secretly envied their stories about their families, their homes. But no longer. Not now that his own family had been returned to him. Not now that Aelin was his home. Even if the walls of her home now pushed on him. He must have looked as caged as he felt, because Aelin rolled her eyes when she came back into the apartment that afternoon. All right, she said, throwing up her hands. I'd rather have you wreck yourself than destroy my furniture from boredom.
You're worse than a dog.
Adian bared his teeth in a smile.
I aim to impress.
So they armed and cloaked themselves and made it 2 steps outside before he detected a female scent, like mint and some spice he couldn't identify, approaching them. Fast. He'd caught that scent before, but couldn't place it. Pain whipped his ribs as he reached for his dagger, but Aelin said, It's Nezrin. Relax. Indeed, the approaching woman lifted a hand in greeting, though she was cloaked so thoroughly that Adian could see nothing of the pretty face beneath. Aelin met her halfway down the block, moving with ease in that wicked black suit of hers, and didn't bother waiting for Adian as she said, Is something wrong? The woman's attention flicked from Adian to his queen. He hadn't forgotten that day at the castle, the arrow she'd fired and the one she'd pointed at him. No, I came to deliver the report on the new nests we've found. But I can return later if you two are busy.
We were just going out, Aelin said, to get the general a drink.
Nezrin's shoulder-length night-dark hair shifted beneath her hood as she cocked her head.
You want an extra set of eyes watching your back?
Adian opened his mouth to say no, but Aelin looked contemplative. She glanced over her shoulder at him, and he knew she was assessing his condition to decide whether she might indeed want another sword among them. If Aelin were in the Bane, he might have tackled her right there. Adian drawled to the young rebel,
What I want is a pretty face that doesn't belong to my cousin. Looks like you'll do the trick.
You're insufferable, Aelin said.
And I hate to tell you, cousin, but the captain wouldn't be very pleased if you made a move on Felique.
It's not like that, Nezrin said tightly.
Aelin lifted a shoulder. It would make no difference to me if it was, the bare honest truth. Nezrin shook her head.
I wasn't considering you, but it's not like that. I think he's content to be miserable.
The rebel waved a hand in dismissal.
We could die any day, any hour. I don't see a point in brooding.
Well, you're in luck, Nezrin Felique, Aelin said. Turns out I'm as sick of my cousin as he is of me. We could use some new company. Adian sketched a bow to the rebel, the motion making his ribs positively ache, and gestured to the street ahead.
After you.
Nezrin stared him down, as though she could see exactly where his injury was groaning in agony, and then followed after the queen. Aelin took them to a truly disreputable tavern a few blocks away. With impressive swagger and menace, she kicked out a couple of thieves sitting at a table in the back. They took one look at her weapons, at that utterly wicked suit of hers, and decided they liked having their organs inside their bodies. The three of them stayed at the taproom until last call, hooded so heavily they could hardly recognize one another, playing cards and refusing the many offers to join other players. They didn't have money to waste on real games. So for currency, they used some dried beans that Adian sweet-talked the harried serving girl into bringing them. Nezrin barely spoke as she won round after round, which Adian supposed was good, given that he hadn't quite decided if he wanted to kill her for that arrow she'd fired. But Aelin asked her questions about her family's bakery, about life for her parents on the southern continent, about her sister and her nieces and nephews. When at last they left the drinking hall, none of them having dared to get inebriated in public, and none of them too eager to go to sleep just yet, they meandered through the alleys of the slums. Adian savored every step of freedom. He'd been locked in that cell for weeks. It had hid an old wound, one he hadn't spoken about to Aelin or anyone else, though his highest-ranking warriors in the Bane knew, if only because they'd helped him exact his revenge years after the fact. Adian was still brooding about it when they strode down a narrow, foggy alley, its dark stones silvered with the light of the moon peeking out above. He picked up the scrape of boots on stone before his companions did, his fey ears catching the sound, and threw out an arm in front of Aelin and Nezrin, who froze with expert silence. He sniffed the air, but the stranger was downwind, so he listened. Just one person, judging from the near-silent footfalls that pierced through the wall of fog, moving with a predator's ease that made Adian's instincts rise to the forefront. Adian palmed his fighting knives as the male's scent hit him, unwashed, but with a hint of pine and snow. And then he smelled Aelin on the stranger, the scent complex and layered, woven into the male himself. The male emerged from the fog, tall, maybe taller than Adian himself, if only by an inch, powerfully built, and heavily armed both above and beneath his pale gray surcoat and hood. Aelin took a step forward. One step, as if in a daze. She loosed a shuddering breath, and a small whimpering noise came out of her. A sob. And then she was sprinting down the alley, flying as though the winds themselves pushed at her heels. She flung herself on the male, crashing into him hard enough that anyone else might have gone rocking back into the stone wall. But the male grabbed her to him, his massive arms wrapping around her tightly and lifting her up. Nezrin made to approach, but Adian stopped her with a hand on her arm. Aelin was laughing as she cried, and the male was just holding her, his hooded head buried in her neck, as if he were breathing her in. "Who is that?" Nezrin asked. Adian smiled. "Rowan."
Chapter 28. She was shaking from head to toe, and couldn't stop crying, not as the full weight of missing Rowan crashed into her, the weight of these weeks alone.
"How did you get here? How did you find me?"
Aelin withdrew far enough to study the harsh face shadowed by his hood, the tattoo peeking out along the side of it, and the grim line of his smile.
"He was here. He was here. He was here."
"You made it clear my kind wouldn't be welcome on your continent," he said. Even the sound of his voice was a balm and a blessing. "So I stowed away on